Is it on? Okay, good morning, everyone. How's everybody doing?
Morning.
Good. Our chairman is running a few minutes late, but we've got quorum, and we're going to go ahead and get started. So, So let's go ahead and get started with some of the discussion items. I think the first item, Commissioner Samuelin, you've got discussion regarding city's homeless walk-in center, so why don't you go ahead and take the lead on that, sir?
I sure will. I'll introduce it, and then I anticipate we'll have Maria from the administration, and I think we have representatives of our homeless committee as well. Real brief background, and Vice Mayor, this is a little bit for your background and how this sort of came up. One is, in our community survey, the number one opportunity our residents said they wanted improvement was on the homeless issue. And this opportunity came to us to have a discussion here at committee. We've done some things. We've increased the number of Marchman beds through MBPD. We are piloting something that was done, I think, over the water with the Lazarus Mental Health Outreach. We've allocated incremental funding to the Homeless Trust, so I'm interested specifically to know what's up with that funding. But the bottom line of this conversation is, how do we do better? What do we do more and different? And that's really the focus. I want to thank the administration for the fact-based memo that came out. I think that was very, very helpful. And I look forward to hearing from the administration and members of the community of how we take it to the next level.
Okay, great. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good, good. Well, we just started on discussion item
number
one, Chairman. We just started. Do you want us to continue?
Good morning.
Yeah, let's go.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Maria Ruiz, Director of Housing and Community Services. First, to address some of your questions that you asked at the front end, we are currently pending the execution of the agreement for the funds for the Miami-Dade County Homeless Trust. So that is actually in process as we speak. With regards to the Lazarus Project, we have now managed to put two people in housing out of the 13 that have been targeted. We're having some issues, of course, with some of the others, and they're a more reluctant group to serve, so it is a bit of a challenge inherently. With regards to relocations, those are up. We're up to 52 in the first quarter, so we're on pace actually to beat this past year's relocation, which was a record number this past year. In terms of shelter placements, we actually have had an influx of families in December that have we've had to place in hotel because we did not have the shelter accommodations to face them. Four of the five families actually originated elsewhere and then came to our community. We have right now spent 25% of our relocation funds to pay for hotel. So we're definitely on pace to have to need more funds to replenish that particular account. And in terms of the walk-in center, as you know, that is the building that is going to be demolished to make room for the Convention Center Hotel. So we are strategizing and putting together in place to be able to go to an all-mobile since we've been unable to find alternative locations for the services. So we've been working on the mobility plan, how it is that we're going to continue to do outreach services, and how we're going to process people in the field to enable that we don't stop services just because we don't have a physical place to operate from.
Maria, if I could just ask one question before we dive into the details. We did allocate incremental funding. You mentioned an agreement is in place. Can you bring to life what incremental service or benefits are we getting from the Homeless Trust?
Yes. Actually, we are. The majority of the money will be used for rapid rehousing, which are those individuals who are currently homeless, to be able to place them into independent private housing. And in fact, the Homeless Trust just voted on Friday to pass those funds to Douglas Gardens Community Health Center. So they'll be managing our local population. We've got 10 people that we've already identified for this program, so we'll be working in conjunction with Douglas Gardens to move those on. Then we have a small portion of the money to enable hotel placement for families, which will be much needed since we've already exceeded what we had expected. And then that final small portion of $5,000 is to cover hostel placement for those homeless who are currently employed in the city of Miami Beach so that they don't have to travel as far to be able to go to housing while maintaining their job here in Miami Beach.
I've got a couple questions. Is that all right? You mentioned you're going to need some more funds to replenish. So what? How much money are we talking about over what period of time?
It's hard to tell at this point. I would probably come back with a report when we get to the 40% of funds being used. But we are currently drawing from the $40,000 that are allocated annually to enable us to put down payment assistance for those homeless who are in shelter who are now transitioning to permanent housing. We've expended $9,000 in hotels. And unfortunately, December was a very busy month, but it was also very expensive because we weren't able to secure hotels in Miami Beach. We had to actually go into Miami because we couldn't find anything available to us. So right now we're down to two families, and we're working on outgoing plans for them. So if the only spike was in December, we should be in okay shape. My concern is if we continue to get more families.
And I know the all-mobile plan. Can you talk about if there's going to be any fiscal impact on that? Will it cost more money to do that as opposed to having an office?
We will be expending more money on fuel and vehicle use, obviously, because we're going to be in the vehicles more often. But in terms of additional expenses, we're working to actually go to paper, to paperless. So hopefully there'll be less paper that we have to occupy, which is a considerable expense just because of the sheer number of people that we serve. I think the hardship is going to be getting the community adjusted to the fact that we're going to be in the field all the time and there isn't a fixed physical location that you can send someone to. That's going to be, I think, the learning curve. But other cities have that model. We hope to improve upon it only in the sense that our goal is also to continue to provide those alternate services, the ID replacement, the relocation services, those services that typically are fixed-based. Our goal is to continue to provide them in a mobile model.
And have you looked at models that other cities have regarding a mobile model? Because I'm curious if in the past when people go to a mobile, if the community sort of self-selects their own place to gather, and, for example, will, because they can't find a place to go and maybe they don't have a phone, will they start just going to the police station, or will they come to City Hall, or will they go to another sister, city facility? Have there been any models that you've looked at?
We've actually studied the models of probably at least 15 different cities, at least. What is interesting is that we already have locations where our homeless tend to congregate. You have Lincoln Road, you have Ocean Drive, you have Collins Park, you have the Symphony, which is locations. So those are already locations that we regularly visit anyway. Those are part of our core group, and that's part of our morning census as well. So in that regard, I don't think that there's going to be that huge difference. Police Department continues to have the capacity to make immediate placements into shelter as well, 24/7. So a person who's looking for services can access it that way as well if they can't locate us. But we actually expect to be more visible as a result. You're going to have more people with our shirts out in the street, and hopefully that's actually going to increase the perception by the community that we're out there trying to be proactive.
Okay, thank you.
That's one of my big questions, is just this mobile model. I'm worried. I'm concerned. I don't have a strong feeling that it's going to work, and I understand our hesitancy and the public's hesitancy about giving you a permanent location. Nevertheless, I think it's incumbent upon us to try to find a permanent location and think about maybe some kind of hybrid model, but your team needs a place to be. You need a place to run your affairs, keep your files, have walk-ins, and deal with things. This mobile model is literally kicking the can down the road because we don't have good alternatives right now, and I don't think most people have the appetite to make a decision that it's going to be in X neighborhood, but it still needs to be done, and it's wrong to kick the can down the road. So what I'd like to do is instruct the administration to think about, I think we're going to have to be in a mobile model for a period of time, but sometime in the next 5 years, with all the projects that we're building, whether it's parking garages or P3s, can there be, as part of that effort, have a centralized location for our homeless outreach department? And potentially, if this mobile model is so good, have a hybrid model where we can be out in the field deploying our people to service this community, but have a centralized place where your team can operate out of and people can walk into. Meaning, I'm going to encourage us to make a decision. It'll be uncomfortable, but having a mobile model is just kicking the can down the road, and I don't think that's the right thing to do.
I share your view. My concern is that the community is going to find a place to congregate, much like they have in the past, because they're homeless. So I'm very worried about the mobile model as well.
I mean, guys, think about it. If this was any other group, not homeless, but a group that had a different profile, we would find them a home. Whether they're children, whether they're seniors, we wouldn't be talking about a mobile model. We're talking about a mobile model because they're homeless. And as a society, we like to ignore them. And that's wrong. And I'm not going to be comfortable with that. So I'm going to encourage us to find a permanent place somewhere. And we'll make it appropriate to accommodate the concerns of the surrounding neighborhoods. But we have to deal with this.
I think you said it. You said it very succinctly. I think you said it.
If you support it, I'd like to encourage the administration to think about, the whole beach, like of all the upcoming projects we have, whether they're garages or P3s or things that we have some control over. And Maria, if you could tell us what your absolute needs are, minimum needs are, in terms of square footage and, facilities, so that we can think about it for future developments. As an aside, we also have this real estate crunch with our own departments. We have so many of our departments that we've outgrown our own city hall, so maybe we should start thinking about, as part of any development, can we start housing some of our departments that are more and more starting to get spread out throughout the city?
Well, what sort of facilities do you have now? How big is your office space? And so
actually, we're at minimum spacing as it is right now. We have a small weight room, two intake stations, and then computer stations for each of the employees on staff.
Talking about 500, 600 square feet?
I would imagine that it's in the neighborhood of less than 500 square feet, if you can put all the spaces together for the homeless office.
Your space?
The homeless office. Remember that the entire department's housed there. But the homeless office is only that the southern side of the building, which is the wait area, the intake station, and then some stations directly in front, and then an office for the director.
But in your perfect world, you'd want them combined?
In the perfect world, you'd always want to put efficiencies of service. Most of our clients need food stamps and other services, so we literally, when they finish getting intaked, they get walked over to the other side that processes them through the Access Florida site. In theory, it's better to keep the services close by, although not in the same space, because you don't want to mix elderly with the homeless. But you do want to have some synergy of function, if at all possible.
Let me ask you, what do we have going on in Old City Hall in terms of all the various departments and tenants there? Because, could that be long-term a location, because it is near the police department and it is centralized where a lot of the homeless currently, reside? Could we move some of the folks out of Old City Hall into, another facility that, is to be determined somewhere in the future?
The only thing I could just comment on is having a first floor accessible space is in your best interest, because we do have mobility impaired persons and we do get frequent visits by the police department because of behavior. So to be able to have a place that we could move in and out quickly and safely for all involved.
Would Old City Hall meet that requirement?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So to answer your previous question on the citywide or City Hall space plan, what our department's doing right now is assessing all city facilities because of that issue that we have, that we've kind of outgrown our space, and we're trying to figure out how much space we really need versus, all these lease spaces that we have. So we're in the process of doing that evaluation as we speak, in addition to this physical security plan that we're trying to assemble as well. So we've looked at Historic City Hall. As Maria mentioned, unfortunately, they need first floor space to be able to deal with walk-in. So we're in the process of that evaluation, and we should have something back in the next few months. But that's looking at every city facility, how many employees, how many services you offer, and what square footage is actually necessary to be able to come up with a comprehensive plan.
Yeah, just one comment about that location. The data suggests that the problem is disproportionately in South Beach. That's where we have the issues. Washington Ave, frankly, has been an area we've had problems. If that opportunity existed, that seems getting closer to the problem. So that's generally a good thing.
And what about? Do we have any facilities at all in North Beach, or is we just doing outreach, mobile outreach there?
We do outreach. We don't have a fixed location in North Beach.
And can you give me a rough idea of what the need is? Is it 50-50 between North Beach and South Beach, or is it 80-20?
It's closer to 91% South Beach, 9% Middle and North Beach combined.
Okay. Okay.
Meaning the solution would probably be in South Beach.
Yeah, I think.
Either we do something in North Beach, it won't service the community.
Hi, Lori Bacham for the Homeless Committee. I just wanted to bring up something. First off, our committee is very supportive of staff having a location that works for them. We know over the last several months that we know it's a stressor on the staff just even knowing that they don't have a permanent home, as it would be for any department. As a private citizen who works a lot mobily, I still need a fixed location. You know, you need that. But something I think, going to Commissioner Areola's concern that came up by some of our committee members who actually work professionally in counseling. They're not here this morning, but I wanted to speak for them. We're all supportive of a hybrid mobile because we do believe actually more outreach in the community is important. However, a concern they brought up for a mobile only is that it doesn't allow for a private setting for some individuals that may be being victimized as homeless people, which is quite prevalent. And if the mobile unit's there, then every person going in, it's aware to the community around them, rather than them being able to go in and ask for help in a private setting. And for instance, one of the committee members brought up, you know, especially in a case, somebody that's been traumatized, many of our homeless couple, oftentimes one of the partners is being abused in that situation, and to have a private counseling spot would not be possible in a mobile-only setting. So I really appreciate that you guys are looking forward to a more permanent solution.
Hi, good morning. Valerie Navarrete, Chair of the Homeless Committee. A couple of suggestions. Yes, they do need an office, especially for the files, or at least until the files are in computers instead of papers. Also, the mobile is a good idea because they can mobilize. This wouldn't be the first mobile office that Miami Beach has. There is one behind the golf club, the golf course, that they have been there for years, and that's a mobile unit. Just as a suggestion, it could be next to the police station. There is a part that nobody can park at in front of the cannon, just an idea. And that would be, you know, protected. The community would be protected because it's next to the police station. Just my 2 cents on that subject. And in other subjects, we do the community and also the committee wants more outreach. The name of the program is Outreach Program. We have been discussing that in the past few months at the committee. We want that the members of that office, the employees of that office, should be more out on the streets and reaching to the homeless. We want the office conducts daily census. There is no need to have every counting every single morning, and we should use that time and that money from the taxpayers to be outreaching to the homeless. Let me see. Oh, we are talking about the treatment beds. It was awesome that the police got more treatment beds. They need more. They need more and more treatment beds, and that was also discussed in the past couple of months on the committee. We need to continue the Lazaro project and expand, going from a pilot to a program for all homeless. Unfortunately, what happens this weekend on Ocean Drive, where a homeless was killed and an officer was wounded, that was apparently a mentally ill person, and this could be avoided. And the officer, I hope the officer, I heard that he's doing better, but you know, this what happened.
Do we know
the
that
officer
for sure
could be
that he was
avoided.
Homeless? Do we know that for sure that he was homeless?
I heard that
let's
he
just be
was
careful
mentally
before,
ill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's
so
just be
that's
careful.
From a liable source. see. Oh, and also to give PD more elbow room in conducting placements when they choose to do so. I think I have said everything. Oh, and the 30 days, of course. The 30 days waiting period for some homeless to be put in shelters. That also we have been fighting for quite some time, for about like a year and a half now, to that 30 days should be officially eliminated. I think I said it all. Did I miss anything?
Thank you. Anybody else? Blake?
Good morning to all. It's nice seeing you guys. I had some running mates, and congratulations to you guys. I appreciate that. This issue is dear to my heart. During my campaign, I went around the city quite a bit and spoke with a lot of people, and everybody's concerned for different reasons. Some people feel that their quality of life is being impacted. Others feel that we're not handling the homeless in a responsible manner and we're not being humane towards them. I think both are true, and I think that North Beach does need a presence. You're talking about all this expansion, hotels, development in North Beach. I think we would need an outreach office in that area as well. I'm currently working with a homeless lady in the North Beach area, and it's just a hardship to get her down to this particular office, so I think the mobile outreach would have its purpose in certain situations it wouldn't. But I do agree having an office sets the precedent that we mean business about this and we're serious about it, and in order to do business, you have to have an office. So I just would encourage us to continue to give the resources to the outreach, because I know the community is willing to spend on things that are effective. They don't want to see our money wasted, and they want to make sure that it's going towards effective types of procedures. I also know some of the community is concerned and would like to maybe do an ad hoc committee like we did for the bullying committee, where we actually can go and study this and maybe come up with some new, fresh ideas. Not to say that what we're doing is not working or is wrong, but maybe we can come up with some new innovative ideas that could supplement what we're currently doing. So I just wanted to voice that. I know that in the North Beach area, though we have a lower population, we have a lot of people that are living on the streets, and I do know that the community is concerned. They feel like they're not being listened to, and they're not getting the attention they need.
Yeah. Blake, just a question. I think you had shared something on social media. Did you want to share anything about, is there a specific area that you wanted addressed?
Well, this kicked off. I mean, I think that's the key thing is, you know, I did a post yesterday, and it blossomed into what we should be doing with the homeless. And personally, at the particular time, to be honest, I was trying to secure that bridge. I felt it was a safety concern. I mean, we have people that are living underneath the bridge, and we have kids playing at the park. I mean, it's a unique situation. I think if it was underneath a road or something, maybe I wouldn't be so concerned about it. But I know the neighbors have made complaints. I know the neighbors have tried to do social media posts on it, and it just haven't been getting any traction. So I've made my attempts. I promised them during my campaign that I would address this issue, and thus that's why I'm here.
And you're talking under the 68th Street Bridge?
63rd Street.
63rd, I'm sorry. So sort of a small quasi-encampment of sorts?
It is. Basically, they can swing around the wall. If you go down there, I've been told they were there numerous times, and I've been down. I could not see until you actually put your camera around. It's kind of precarious to get there. So I don't know how they actually get in and out. Maybe there's more access. I only went from the north side. Maybe the south side has better access. But I think we need to secure that particular area because, I mean, it just, I think there was even an axe underneath the thing. So I just, there's some concerns. I just, you know, some concerns.
Thank you for sharing that. Colleagues, this is a complex topic. I'm trying to break this down a little bit. I think we could maybe think of this in three broad buckets, just because Commissioner Arriola likes and always kids me that everything comes in threes. Number
I missed
one.
You.
Yeah, thank you. Good to be back. Number one is I think we want the administration to take a look at a central location and that's a priority, getting closer to the field in some way while we proceed with mobile. That's number one. Number two, I think this situation under the 63rd Street Bridge needs to be addressed immediately. So I think that's a hard action. Whoever is, it's our homeless group, MBBD, I think we should be on that. The third, in a little more complex, might warrant more discussion, is the following. How do we best allocate any incremental resources to help people and address the problem? You know, we were talking about something with the homeless trust. I think that was circa $5 million ask. I don't think we had the desire at that point. But I think there's at least four things that we might consider, and maybe my request here would be for the administration to look at these. do we need more Marchman beds? We just funded them, so if we need more, let's have that conversation. Do we need more Lazarus than we've funded? That would be number two. I heard outreach. Do we need incremental resources on outreach? I don't know, but I heard at least our homeless trust committee, our homeless committee mentioned that's third. And the fourth, I'm going to add, it sounds like our 125 is buying us some goodness from the homeless trust and that we think that's good. Now, my question would be, and they have this housing first philosophy, which we did not have the appetite for $5 million taxing our businesses, but if we have evidence and if we believe there's a program there, if 125 addresses a certain amount of people, should we consider incremental funding for that homeless trust pilot of sorts? Maybe we need to see how that first 125 goes. So my recommendation, sort of in the form of a, you know, a bit of a motion here, I guess is one, while we proceed with this mobile, that we explore a permanent location. Number two, we address the situation under the bridge on number 63rd Street expeditiously. And number three, let's allow the administration to look at these various policy levers and programs and come back to us with how they think we would best be positioned if it's the will of the body to allocate more resources.
So, thank you, Chair. I would use a stronger word on your first point. Instead of explore,
okay,
I think we should direct the administration to come back with hard, concrete suggestions on where we could have an office. I think I have serious concerns about the mobile approach. And so rather than explore, because, you know, explore leaves a lot of wiggle room, right? Mm-hmm. So I'd say let's find
– We're going to be best friends.
Yeah. So let's direct the administration to come back with some concrete ideas on how to, and then if they can't find a place, let them come back and tell us they can't find a place, right? And then on, I would just add on the bridge issue, because I dealt with this issue on 71st Street probably 4 or 5 years ago as the state rep, where there was some folks living under that bridge. That is a state road, and so I had to get the state involved.
Okay.
And actually what we did is built some barriers. Uh-huh. The police were kind enough to come up with me so I could do an inspection, and then the state jumped in and built some barriers where it was not possible to have an encampment under that bridge. So, you know, may be that the state's going to have to get involved, because I believe that's a state road.
I think those are good additions. I am comfortable with the edit to the first part to direct, as you suggested, and on the bridge specifically, in addition to addressing the immediate problem, I think if I'm hearing you right, perhaps collaboratively with the state to see if we need some physical structure for a more permanent solution. I'm comfortable adding those 2 points in.
And Commissioner Samuel?
Yes.
Your third point about the policy levers,
correct.
How do you want to direct staff on that?
Here's my recommendation. I think there are at least four things, and I would like the administration to look at those four: Marchman treatment beds, expanding Lazarus, more outreach like we do today, and incremental funding on top of the 125 for the homeless trust. Digest it, look at them, and say, if I had an extra dollar, here's how I'd spend it. Come back to this committee.
Well, you know on that third point how I feel, so I'm very supportive, and I'd push it even further, but let's get some recommendations. On the first one, you know, I threw out Old City Hall just because that's an asset that we own. There are other buildings, but I'd like to have some concrete recommendations, like real analysis, and I don't want to take months on this. Like, I could just look at Old City Hall. Who are the tenants? We just moved the IG in there. They don't have to be there. We can move them to another facility. We can rent space, we could build space. You know, what's the most appropriate place in our judgment where homeless outreach should be located, and then work backwards from there? If we have to move people, we can move people. But, you know, finding a home for our homeless outreach department is much harder than finding an office for our illustrious Inspector General. So I would work backwards. You know, what particularly in South Beach, where could this go, and then work backwards?
I really like the idea if we could find space at the Old City Hall, because it's close to the police department, mm-hmm. but I think it would be a real mistake to have the outreach in the police department, because I think it sends a wrong message that someone needing services would have to go to the police, and we don't want that. So, I know, but I'm saying I would not want, for the message, I would not want the outreach office to be in the police station. I would, the Old City Hall is close by, that would be fine, you know, in close proximity. So yeah. I think that would be a good location if we could find it.
Yeah, if I could just, I think we have strong consensus here that we want to look for a facility. We've heard the problem is 90% plus South Beach. I think that Washington Avenue has some stuff going. So as we start that analysis, working backwards, as the chair suggested, I do think Old City Hall is a very rational, logical place to start and see why might that not work, if at all. I would agree with that.
Yeah. And I know we're contemplating building, you know, a potential fire station down on 6th Street. You know, might that be a place where we would expand that facility? But let's try to come up with a solution, because we will kick this can down the road for years and years unless we come up with something concrete, like a definitive plan. I'd like to have some kind of answer in 2020, not that we move in 2020, but at least know where your home would be, you know, some kind of conclusive answer in 2020.
So, Mr. Chair, I made the motion, and, you know, some good edits. We talked about the location and the potential couple options you mentioned, including Old City Hall, the barriers for the bridge. You said 2020. I was talking February. I'd like to have an update.
You're my best friend.
Yeah, thank you. I think we want to keep this conversation going and make progress. So I'd like to hear a report back on these three items at our next finance meeting.
Okay, that concludes item number one.
You're okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Right. There are a couple items. Item number 12 is going to take a little while, so I want to try to get through two or three items before we tackle that one. I know there's some folks here for item number three, so I'll take that one unless there are any objections. Okay. Item number three is a discussion regarding the Miami Beach Community Development Corporation and its financial condition. Who's going to present? And let's kind of be brief. I know you have a lot to say, but we have a busy agenda.
My name is Ahmed Martin. I'm executive director of the Miami Beach Community Development Corporation. The last hearing, there were four areas that the committee required an update on. One was vacancy, capital needs, sustainability, and file compliance. In terms of vacancy, we currently have 9 vacancies within the portfolio of 323 units. There are 2 major rehabilitation projects which are going to require relocation of residents. One is the Shelbourne, in which 19 residents are going to require relocation to do a gut rehabilitation of the building. We've hired Housing Opportunities Unlimited, which is a HUD-certified specialist, in order to relocate the residents. They'll be taking care of everything on the front end and the back end to make sure that there's a smooth transition for the residents. The second building is the Jefferson, in which we have to do a basically rework the first floor structural members. So the first floor residents will have to be vacated. There's 5 individuals there that will have to be vacated, and we are also working with Housing Opportunities Unlimited to do that. In terms of sustainability, we are still unfortunately making capital need repairs out of the operating budget, and that is until we can come up with a comprehensive financial plan. We're working with the National Equity Foundation, which is a subsidiary of LISC. They are a national syndication and nonprofit advisory firm that will be helping us evaluate each of the capital stacks for each of the properties. They're each a mix of conventional and forgivable debt. So they'll be untangling that and helping us come up with an action plan moving forward. The other area of concern was file maintenance or compliance. We've received notices of noncompliance for 4 of our properties and cured those deficiencies within the cure period. Just some additional comments. I've renewed my contract with the CDC, so I will be there for another 12 months. We've added 3 additional board members, all from the University of Miami Law Program with a concentration in real estate. We've instituted weekly conference calls with the City of Miami Beach Housing Department to ensure that there is constant communication and to get ahead of issues before they arise. And that's it.
Comments? Do we have their financials? Do we have their financials, Andy?
We had received some financials from the organization last year. We haven't received anything from this past quarter or representative of this coming year. We have not.
Great.
What's your fiscal year? Is it the calendar
930.
Year? I'm sorry?
930.
Have you closed your books for last year, for 19?
For 18, yes. For 19, no.
Yeah. Oh, for September.
We've closed the books, but we haven't. We're just starting the audit process for fiscal year 19. I know you're new to this committee, but we did explain at the last committee that there was significant, almost forensic accounting analysis, which had to be done in order to basically understand where the organization was and to finish the audit for fiscal year 2018. The former CFO actually left the organization before closing out the books for fiscal year 2018.
Okay, so let's just take them one at a time.
Sure.
For 18, for the period ending September 30th of 2018, what's the status of that audit?
That audit will be complete in the next 2 weeks, but we're also simultaneously starting.
Well, let's just stick with 18 if we can for just a moment. So, and you have an outside audit firm, and they're going to be publishing, they'll be releasing the report within the next 2 weeks?
Correct.
So we can...
By the end of the month.
By the end of the month. So would it be fair to say that we could have a copy of that audit in our February meeting?
Of course.
Okay, great. So we'll expect it then, okay? Mm-hmm. And then, now what about in 19? For September 30th of 19, have we identified an auditor for that? Is it the same audit firm or is it a different audit firm?
It's the same audit firm.
Okay. Have they started their work yet?
No. Because it's the same audit firm, they're closing out 2018. We have one entity of 15 to complete, and then they're going to begin the work for 19. We have received the audit request list for 19. So we're gathering the documentation, but they haven't started to do their work.
Okay. And have they given you an estimate of how long it's going to take to complete that audit?
I would say 90 days.
90 days. Okay. All right. Well, when we come back next month in February, maybe you can give us an update on that as well, if that's okay.
We were on the agenda for, I guess, meeting every quarter. Is it possible to submit, like, a written report or to stay on the agenda every quarter, but every month?
We've been asking you to come every quarter, but I think Commissioner Richardson's request, and I support it, if you think you're going to have financial data that you can provide us sooner, like in February, that would be helpful because we're constantly challenged to make a decision whether to sort of continue supporting you or to dissolve you and give this to the county. And, you know, time is of the essence. We want to make sure that you're on the right path because people are living in these apartments, and to the extent that they're in substandard condition, we don't want that to go on a day longer than it needs to. So we need to make sure that you are in compliance with everything you need to be in compliance with, and that if there's any outstanding issues with these apartments, they're being timely addressed.
I think go ahead.
Can I make one request to appear at the March hearing? I'm actually not going to be here for the date of the February hearing.
Well, do you have somebody you can send in your stead?
Yeah.
So what I'd like, if we can, Chair and Commissioner Samuelin, since the audit's going to be available in the next couple of weeks, send that over to us before the meeting, before the February, so we'll all have it. We can digest it, and then someone can come in February, and if we have any questions about that, and also if you could just let us know if we're on track for getting the next report, because, you know, basically, it's taken more than a year to get the audit for 18. It seems like it's, I'm counting like 14 months or so, more than that, probably 15 or 16. So I don't want it to take 16 months to get the 19 report, you know? And if it's going to, then we should be aware of that now, okay? So if that's okay, can we agree to that?
I'm supportive.
No, I'm good. Remind me, how many units approximately is your agency responsible for?
323. Yes.
Okay. Here's how I look at this. You know, we have 323 units within the city of Miami Beach. These are our residents.
And we want to make sure that those residents, at least as far as housing is concerned, have adequate housing, and that to the extent that there's any issues with those apartments, that they're timely addressed by a responsible party. And in the past, this agency, prior to the new board formation, has had its struggles, and we have been challenged with the decision to whether just dissolve this relationship and let the county manage these properties. And as I was thinking about this over the weekend, I started thinking, you know, sometimes small is good, meaning, you know, a locally formed board focusing on a smaller portfolio than the county is going to be managing would give the residents of these units more timely response, better housing. But to the extent that that's not being done, there's also economies of scale where, you know, the county just has a lot more resources that can throw at this issue.
To that point, we have the same property management company as the county.
Yeah, but the issue is that you're going to have to get us comfortable that you can do a better job in the county, because I'll speak for me. I don't want to keep rehashing this issue of having you come forward to validate your existence. So we got to get to a place where this is something we don't have to worry about, that we know that the 323 units under your portfolio are taken care of, and taken care of in a manner that's better than the county could do.
Agreed.
So there's a lot of challenges, and Maria, I'd like to call you up. There's some data here that there's some tenant complaints. Some of these, I think, probably are just par for the course of any landlord-tenant relationship. So there's the financial aspect, and then there's the living aspect. In the past, we've seen some very troublesome pictures of apartments that, you know, were very, very concerning. How are we doing? How are these apartments looking?
The Jefferson, which is the property that we brought to your attention that had the floor that was collapsing, I think we're finally getting into the nitty-gritty of finding a general contractor and a timeline to be able to do that work. It hasn't commenced as of yet. I was on site on Friday because one of the tenants called me, and conditions are still poor at the building. We also still have the chairlift that's now going on a year and a half at the VM Mati that we haven't cleared yet from our list. So there are a few items. I think from a staff perspective, the thing we're most concerned about is that a lot of the tenants are calling us directly. And one of the things we have to continue to stress is that the agency needs to build a stronger relationship with its tenants so that they feel comfortable going to the agency and not circumventing and coming to us. I think that puts us in an adversarial position sometimes, which is not the intent. So we need to build a better relationship with the tenants.
I've asked my colleague, Commissioner Richardson, to volunteer to go physically look at these buildings for his own satisfaction, because I'm only relying on pictures, but I'd like to get your opinion. Sure. When you go look at these. And then to the extent that we feel that they're in great condition or not, that I think can drive some of our decisions ultimately on what we do here.
Yeah, let's do it.
If things need to be fixed, they need to be fixed. People are living in these units. And, you know, I know you have an amazing board, and I'm very impressed with you. But, you know, sometimes we can't do all the things that we want to do, and the decision we'll ultimately have to make is whether the county or some other entity could do it faster and better.
Okay. So if we can just wrap up. So I know you won't be here, but if you could send to our offices the financial audit report with any attachments that we would need to understand those as soon as you get it, and certainly before the February meeting, mm-hmm. And then we'll look it over, and if we have any questions, and if your assistant's not able, but if you're not able to answer any questions, you know, all of our questions, maybe we'll follow up, but we'll certainly, I want to talk about this at the next meeting.
I'll also have Kaufman Rossen is the accounting team.
Perfect.
This is Shahrazad Imami, yep. The attorney for the CDC. They can come in February because they will be able to explain the details of the audit should you have technical details.
I think
about
that's great.
Audit.
I think that's great. And then just they can also tell us what they anticipate their end date on the 19 report as well, if it's going to take a year or 3 months or 90 days or whatever it is. Okay.
Right.
So just a note, the fiscal year 2018 audit won't reflect any of the administrative changes that took place.
I understand.
Okay.
I understand.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And to me, the financials is one data point, an important data point, but the physical quality of the asset is probably the most important thing in my mind, and I just want to satisfy myself that things are going in the right direction.
Mr. Chair, may I have just 30 seconds? Jeff Feldman, Vice Chairman of the MBCDC Board of Directors. I just want to make sure, because there's always, we feel like we're always in this he said, she said game where we hear from you things that are, may have been true at some point in the past or are partially or kind of close to reality. I want to just clarify, the lift has been fixed, we're waiting on inspection, and that's been since almost close to, well, early December since it was complete. It wasn't easy, it's an old lift, we're trying to find parts. We never don't sit around, we don't just sit around not doing things. The Jefferson has a problem. The problem was discovered. We had to go through an engineering process. We had to get multiple bids for the engineering. We have to get multiple bids for the construction. It's not like we're sitting around waiting. We are going through a process. The holidays didn't help. So we have been and continue to do all the things to right these properties. We discovered some stuff at the Shelburne. Look, our portfolio needs a redevelopment in general. These are old 1920s, 1930s Miami Beach products, housing products. Sure. Whether you own it as a private investor or a nonprofit like us, they all require remediation at some point in time. We don't get to just do it.
So
it's a process,
Jeff,
for us.
I think that's a fair commentary. However, for the people living in those facilities, they're living there. They're living it, right?
Correct.
So for the person who needs the lift, they, you know, are not, are they going to be less concerned about the fact that it's an old lift and you got to get this part, you got to get that part, because they need it, right?
Right.
So it's a fair comment, but at the end of the day, the people need the services, they need the facilities.
Understood.
And, you know, for example, the flooring that's out, how long has that been out? Months, it sounds to me.
Right, so. But it's one of those problems, and I'm a developer and I'm a contractor. I do a lot of work here in Miami Beach. I've built hotels from the 1920s. Oftentimes, and anybody knows if you've spent any time in these buildings, you don't know about the problem until you know about the problem. You can't know what's behind a wall, what's underneath a floor. You don't know till it's a problem. Then you know. So we are working. We've been working. We've been working extremely hard to get back to this point. You know, we're going to find a private sector development partner to redevelop the portfolio ultimately. And, you know, we've worked very well with the county of late to make sure that we're all on the same page. And by the way, the county, if you read in the Herald, has two properties that they have to evacuate all of its tenants in an emergency situation because they did not do a good job of caring for their properties. All of them, hundreds.
And that's what we want to avoid here.
Yeah. So that's the big, great county that everybody thinks we bow to, but they are equally, if not more, guilty.
And Jeff, and that's why you're still in the game, because we're aware the county has its challenges. It's the point I was making earlier, which is sometimes it's small. It's good to be small, but sometimes the challenges are so overwhelming for a volunteer board. And
let me assure you, Ricky, that the challenges on our situation are not overwhelming for us anymore. Now that we finally have some breathing room and we've stabilized everything, we're working really well with Maria and her department. We're now sort of able to, like I said, I think last time, we're like 85 to 90% there. We do have some things still to complete, and we're going to get information to you, but we are much closer today than we were a year and a half ago. So thank you for
that. Yeah, it's actually been almost 2 years since we realized the extent of the problems and then worked to, you know, get rid of the old administration and get a new board. And, you know, I mean, it's really been, we've rebuilt the organization from the ground up. And what I wanted to say is that the tenant complaints in the past several months, they've actually gone down. So we've been working with Royal American. We now have weekly calls with them. And the City of Miami Beach staff, Maria Ruiz and her staff, are invited every week to attend those calls so that we can get on top of the issues in a more expeditious manner.
And we reach out to our tenants all the time. That's a myth that we don't have a good relationship with them. Whether they know to call us or to call the city, I don't know what phone number they have on their refrigerator magnet. I don't know how to make them call us. But we have, Ahmed, have we not? Many notices. Monica has knocked on every door inside the portfolio. I mean, we have done we've had meetings with the entire community. We have done everything we could possibly do to get them to know to call us. Some of them just feel like they need to call the city for whatever reason. We don't like it any more than they like it, you know. And when you own, you said it, Commissioner, when you own 13, 14 buildings, 300-400 units, 323 units, I mean, with seniors, sick folks, you know, people that aren't not necessarily handy, everything's a problem all the time. I mean, and I mean that sincerely. The air conditioning goes out. We're in Miami Beach. We're in an 89, 92-year-old building. I mean, of course we're going to have calls. But we're on it. I mean, we don't miss it.
Yeah. I mean, I ideally, being small and local makes you more responsive, quicker reaction time and all that. And I believe that to be the case. But if we can confirm that, then this model works much better for our residents than giving it to the county, which has to administer, I don't know, tens of thousands of units. So we just want to get comfortable. You know, we're doing our job to make sure.
We'll keep coming to make sure you're comfortable.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. What's the appetite to do number 12? It's going to take a while.
Let's do it.
Okay. Sure. Let's do number 12. Let's talk about off-duty police on Ocean Drive. I don't know who wants to tee this up. I'll speak for myself, but I think I speak for all of us. Chief, I know we had a rough weekend. Our thoughts and prayers are with the officer that was injured, as well as the entire department. Our thanks to you and the department for putting your lives on the line to keep us safe. You know, this ordinance is with an eye towards keeping the public safe, as well as our officers.
Commissioner, thank you. Commissioner Samuel, and obviously Commissioner Richardson, well, thank you very much for your appreciation. I know the officer has appreciated all the outpouring and the calls that he has received over the last 2 days, and I'm pleased to say that he's on the road to recovery. He should be doing very well. He's going to have a couple more days that he's going to need to stay in the hospital, but we're looking forward to getting him back hopefully sometime in the near future.
Mr. Chair, before we proceed with this item, can I just give a little bit of background real briefly? In your agenda, you do have a form-approved version, and that form-approved version was something that ultimately we were able to ascertain after evaluating all the legal components and various other concepts that we factored into in conjunction with the police department and what they were able to ultimately accomplish. This version that is within your packet is a little bit different than what was presented at first reading. Now, since this packet ultimately was distributed to the members, there was a meeting that was held with the stakeholders, with the police department, and with the a commission representative. That happened Friday morning, approximately 11 o'clock. After that meeting, there was a successful, ultimately, determination regarding the ordinance. There should have been an amendment that was passed out that you should have. That amendment ultimately has a certain provisions that were shaded in. Those shaded in provisions ultimately are the difference between what is in your packet and what is presently before you today. If you do not have that addendum, please let me know. So those addendums start at page number 5. You'll see there's two shaded portions. If you turn to the very next page, there's another shaded portion as well. That was presented to the stakeholders on Ocean Drive along with their council. They ultimately have agreed unequivocally with everything that is contained in that addendum. We made certain that the Ocean Drive Association and their rep had no issues with this proposed version of the ordinance, along with council for Mangoes and along with the Clevelander representative. There was no opposition. They agreed 100% with that version. And then along with the chief ultimately also is in agreement as well. So with that, I want you to understand what we're working with is that version right there, and I'm going to turn it over to the police chief, and he can identify specifically what we're trying to accomplish, especially now considering what transpired over this past weekend and the importance of what it is that we're trying to do with this ordinance.
Again, thank you, Mr. Boxner, with regards to that. Really, for the most part, what we've heard from Ocean Drive, obviously, is a desire to get back Ocean Drive in the key locations, if you will, and that is that where the crowds generally go to. between 9th and 11th Street is the focal point, if you will, for the nightlife area. Some suggestions have come out from our Citizens Police Advisory Committee, from obviously local activists, asking for stationary officers, in those areas. And when they describe that, what they're describing to me from what I grew up in this police department historically is off-duty. You know, that's what we do. So in listening to what the ODA has asked for over the past 2 years, and really for the most part what the suggestions have been, and, couple that with my experience with the department, re-implementing the off-duty policy, if you were the off-duty program on Ocean Drive, when I took over in July, was really one of the first things that I wanted to do. So this is a pilot program. We sat down with legal, we sat down with the stakeholders, if you will, and we said, hey, let's look at it, and let's see how bringing back off-duty on Ocean Drive will affect not only the perception that people have of not being safe, if you will, because that was one of the other challenges I had, is changing that perception, but also changing the climate a little bit. And by that, I mean making sure that we have a presence there, that's not mobile. What I didn't want to do is I didn't want to use on-duty resources, if you will, in order to be able to be fixed, if you will, fixed positions or fixed posts along the Ocean Drive. I think that takes away from our ability to be able to effectively police it. So right now, again, my special thanks to obviously legal and Mr. Boxner for bringing all the parties together. I think we have a really good ordinance in place. And by that, I mean from a trial perspective, to look at it, to see how this can affect it. And in the event that we need to modify it a little bit, we can. And I think everybody's willing to at least look at it and take those factors into consideration.
And Mr. Chair, I can get into the specifics if you have any questions of the ordinance.
Before we do that, I just want to, anything from my colleagues?
So thank you, and thanks for coming in, and thanks again for all the service you do, and what happened over the weekend is really horrific, and we thank you every day that you guys are doing the job that you're doing. So I know you guys have spent a lot of time trying to get this where we want it. I want to talk about resources on Ocean Drive before we implement this and after. So is there a plan by the department to reduce the normal paid presence if we have off-duty, or will we continue to have the same level of service that we have now, and this will be adjunct and supplemental above that?
My plan is not to reduce services on Ocean Drive at all, not the on-duty component. This is a force multiplier for us. Okay, this is about visibility. About being stationary at these locations that, we generally feel attract more people and ultimately calls for service. What we're going to gauge, if you will, with regards to evaluating the effectiveness is the fact if calls for service do go down, if we're able to go ahead and we're able to take care of these problems in their infancy before they become larger scale issues. And by that, I mean taking something that may start as a verbal dispute between two people and stopping that from escalating into a more violent confrontation. That's the focal point of this. It's a force multiplier for us. That's how I've always looked at it. And again, going forward, that's exactly what we plan on doing.
So, because you understand the nature of the question, right?
Sure.
So I would not want to put this in place and then have the businesses paying for police services and then us reduce what we're doing now on the street. So I just want to make sure that's not the plan, right?
That's fair enough, Commissioner. And again, policing the entertainment district is a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day venture. And by putting off-duty officers there and the agreed days upon, if you will, are Friday and Saturday night from 12 a.m. to 5:30 a.m. as well, it's a force multiplier for us, basically, during what we consider to be the peak days and peak hours for activity on the ODA. And in particular, that particular area from 9th to 11th Street.
Okay. And then are you comfortable with the latest version of the ordinance that we're looking at today? Is this something that you're prepared to say that you fully support, or would you like to see changes to it?
No, I'm comfortable with it. But one of the things I am comfortable about it probably the most is the ability to be able to reevaluate it over time to determine its effectiveness. Something what we're doing here is we're establishing guidelines, if you will, through the ordinance and really giving us the ability to be able to evaluate if its effectiveness 6 to 9 months down the road to see if we're headed down the right direction, to see if we were right on both sides, both sides of the equation. One side was the ODA asking for it. And then on the other side, the police department looking at it as a force multiplier. So, yes, I am comfortable with it.
Okay. And do you think that you have the manpower to provide the services? Because I know one of the things we've talked about over the last few months is the supply and the demand for off-duty. And so are you comfortable that you have the supply of off-duty officers who can fulfill the demand?
Well, we've gotten away from off-duty at clubs, and particularly on Ocean Drive over the past few years due to an unfortunate incident that happened a couple years ago. So we're re-implementing the program now. What we do have is we have coordinators that are assigned to each particular venue that are tasked with coming up with support, as you will, from their peers. It's slowly starting to evolve. I know that, you know, again, we've had some conversations with the ODA about, you know, again, officers being available to do that. I am in conversations with the union on taking other steps to ensure that there is a presence that's there. But I think over time, I think we're going to be able to get back to that. Historically, you know, going back to, you know, again, when I grew up in the organization, we had clubs not only on Ocean Drive, but also on Washington Avenue that were staffed by off-duty. So it's just a matter of getting it back. I think we will. We're going to encourage it. And we're going to do everything we can in order to be able to obviously accommodate the need on both sides.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let me add my thanks to the police chief, his leadership, our officers, and our thoughts. You all put yourselves on the line for us all the time, and we certainly appreciate it, and we wish him a very, very speedy recovery.
Thank you.
I want to pick up on a couple things you said. You mentioned, Chief, a couple times about the entertainment district, and we had officers on Washington Ave. I can understand we're talking a lot about Ocean Drive, and that makes sense, but the problems don't all end on Ocean Drive. So could you talk a little bit about other locations on Washington Ave and how you see that we might use off-duty holistically in the MXE?
We do have locations that encompass with the MXE or within the MXE, and then those that border the MXE. Oftentimes, that can be challenging. And generally, what we've seen with those are promoter based. So, if there's an event that's coming to town that, you know, may be more popular for a certain weekend, you know, we've seen those locations spike up, if you will, for calls for service. But as far as consistency goes, it's hit or miss. And again, I don't mean to be flipping about that, but, you know, really, for example, and I'll throw out there, you know, the Cameo. The Cameo, you know, may not have any activity at all in it, you know, for two or three weekends a month, but then may have one or two long weekend events that, you know, where they go and they promote an event, and that causes some concern basically because of the crowds and the number of people that they get there due to the popularity of the event. So the challenge is determining where those events are occurring. And to look at it and determine whether or not, you know, we can encourage those venues to hire off-duty. Mm-hmm. Now, in fairness to the Cameo, I will tell you that they've been very good when we've told them about this, that they've come forward and they've actually reached out to our off-duty office and inquired about getting off-duty, just not permanent off-duty. And that's pretty much what this ordinance kind of focuses on, is really, for the most part, a permanent off-duty fixture, if you will, on Friday and Saturday nights on Ocean Drive and with the establishments that have come forward and asked for that. So that's predominantly, I think, the first question that you have. I'd like to be able to look at, again, in the future, looking at calls for service, looking at the types of calls for service that the particular venue has, whether it's on Ocean Drive or whether it's on Collins Avenue or Washington Avenue, and be able to go back to that establishment and really point out the need, if you will, for them to be able to go ahead and take the initiative and ask for off-duty in those locations. If that does not work, then obviously we'll be in conversation with City Legal to see what other options that we may have legally to do, and obviously I'm going to defer to them, obviously, first and foremost, before any decision is made to pursue that.
That's helpful. And I understand crawl, walk, run. Ocean Drive's the intense area, so focusing there, and I'm comfortable and supportive of the ordinance. I would like, as we do this sort of look back on how it's going, et cetera, that we are contemplating other geographies, if there's some hot spots on Washington Avenue, other areas. So I would like that to be part of our thinking, because the issue is not just on Ocean Drive, and I want to make sure that we're thinking holistically about the areas we have problems. So I would like that incorporated on a go-forward basis as we assess the program.
Yes, sir.
I share your view on that, and so let's think collectively on how we could accomplish that if we should incorporate where we require monthly briefings for the next 3 months after this is implemented, or how should we gather that information?
Chief, do you think 30 days is enough time that you'll have insight? Do you need perhaps 90 days you could come back with a review? What would be a time frame that you'd say, I saw it, we passed this on Ocean Drive, here's what's happening, now I'm ready to have the conversation about a few other hot spots, if you will?
I think that you doing a quarterly review, at least if nothing else on Ocean Drive, you know, gives us an opportunity to be able to see if the effectiveness of the program is going in the direction that we want it to. Moreover, we can start taking a look at other venues, you know, throughout the MXC, where, and we have to gauge things like calls for service. I think that's probably the greatest indicator, if you will, and the types of calls for service that we're getting. You know, I mean, it could, you know, it could vary everything from something as simple as a verbal disagreement, if you will, to something that's a little bit more violent under the Part 1 criteria. But we can devise something to give you some kind of a feel, if you will, for what's going on, you know, holistically in the MXC. And then once again, I would defer to legal with regards to what, you know, what we can do with that information and how that we could pursue. We could pursue that challenge.
Yeah. Is that every 9 days, every quarter?
Yeah. So then I would just ask legal if we need to amend this. I mean, basically the police, they work for us. So I think we can call them for a report when we want. But do you think it's important that would we need to amend this to require a 90-day report?
We can also just throw it on the agenda. What we've done in the past is we just throw it on the agenda as a standing agenda item for the full commission every 90 days and just instruct staff, yeah, you know, for the next year, every 90 days, we want to report.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, it doesn't have to be in the legislative, unless you want it in the legislation.
Well, I think to Commissioner Salmon, and I don't want to speak for you, so I think what we're saying is that we would like to have a status report on how it's going on Ocean Drive after 90 days and every quarter, but also we would like you to give us your counsel and your advice on whether or not there are other areas of the city that could benefit from this type of program. Both of those things, I think that's what you're saying.
Right? That's exactly what I'm saying, and well summarized. So I think what we may be able to do is pass this ordinance as is, but also that it is the will of this body that the police department explore these other areas and come back to us in 90 days with their assessment of, given what's happening on Ocean Drive, are there other areas to expand to? I don't know if that will be in the ordinance or a motion from this body, per se.
What I would recommend is that when it goes to commission at first reading on this Wednesday, I would recommend that there be a separate motion made to that effect, and then that would be the way to ultimately treat that. We always anticipated, and I've spoken with the chief on this, that we would evaluate this 6 to 9 months once we'd be able to really gauge kind of the seasonal shifts that we experience in the city. And I think we need to experience the seasonal shifts and the varied influx of activities that we have in order to really provide a knowledgeable response to the mayor and city commission. So that would be my recommendation, okay, is that the commission meeting on Wednesday, that there be a separate motion made to that effect.
And if I may, Alex, can we also, given, I sense we have consensus from this body, can we, with our favorable view of the ordinance, add that motion coming out of finance here to the full commission?
Sure, absolutely.
I would like to do that.
And Alex, you mentioned 6 months, but I think what we're talking about is we would like a status report after 90 days.
No, I recognize that. I was just letting you know what the chief and I have spoken is that we anticipate that once it gets up and running, mm-hmm, we'll able to really be able to address it. I recognize that every 90 days, just as a more clear understanding on where the police is coming from in terms of what they're able to staff.
Yeah.
I know you want to go through
it. If you want me to, I will.
We're going to go through this on Wednesday. So yep. if this is going to pass now.
I only want to hear from the Ocean Drive Association.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anybody from the public want to speak on this? Ceci, Mike, you want to speak on this, or are you okay? Do you have any comments?
I think we are. Ceci Velasco, the executive director of the Ocean Drive Association. I have been part of this process from the beginning. I appreciate the city bringing us in. The city attorney's office has gone through every single one of our points. We've come to terms with all of them. This is a very good document. We're supporting it. But I do want to appreciate the fact that the city has requested and has worked with the stakeholders throughout the entire process. But we're good with this. We see the compromises. We see where it's essential. We've been asking for off-duty. Please know that you will have more off-duty than what is required by this ordinance. This is only the minimum standard because a lot of these venues are going to ask for additional days voluntarily on their own accord. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, I want to hear from the owners as well. Because Legal mentioned that they work with the stakeholders, and that's Ocean Drive Association, the Clevelander and Mangoes, I would like to hear from the representatives of those if they want to speak. If not, they can just wave and say, we're okay. So is the Clevelanders okay with this as written, and is Mangoes okay with this as written? They both have indicated they are, so let's move forward.
Okay. All right, somebody want to make a motion?
Yeah, so I will make a motion that we adopt this ordinance here in the committee and send this back on first reading to the commission on this Wednesday.
Yeah, and I'm in favor, and just a friendly amendment, that we would incorporate the 90 quarterly reviews and direct the administration to assess other locations and, based on the results, come back to us at those reviews of opportunities to expand to other locations.
Okay, great. Motion passes.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate the
and thanks to the legal team. Thanks to all the stakeholders who worked so hard on this. I know I've worked closely with you for the past month and a half on this, and it's been a labor of love, but I think we've got a pretty good piece of legislation. I'll just say I'll talk more about this on Wednesday. In the interest of time, I didn't speak on this today, but I think this is a good step in the right direction to have more police presence on Ocean Drive to keep our public safe, but it's not going to be, a magic bullet. We have a lot more work to do. I have some things on the agenda on Wednesday to talk about that, you know, some other ideas, and I know we have the South Beach bid, which is something we're also going to be considering. There's a lot to pick apart as we try to solve the the MXC Ocean Drive issue. This weekend was, a perfect illustration that it is no one establishment creating the issue. It's the whole area. It's been attracting a crowd that I think we otherwise wouldn't want. And we don't want to put our police officers in harm's way. We certainly don't want to put our guests and residents in harm's way. And what do we need to do in order to make that area not inviting to people who want to come and cause trouble? And so this is a step in that direction, but I think there's more that still needs to be done. And I think we'll have a lengthier discussion on Wednesday about that.
Great.
Okay. There's some folks here for item number 18, which had initially been listed as deferred, but there's some urgency to it. This is a discussion regarding the sponsorship of the Ground Up Music Festival. Are there representatives here who wish to speak about this? And maybe let's hear from staff first to tee this up. Matt, do you want to tee this up for us, why we're looking at this?
Good morning, Commissioners. Matt Kenny, Director of Tourism and Culture. So this is a funding request from the Ground Up Music Festival for $100,000 and a three-year contract in place. Originally, the administration had recommended that this be deferred because we are working through sponsorship guidelines and how we process sponsorship requests that come in. And so the administration recommended that it be deferred, but it was asked that it be heard today. So I know Paul from Ground Up is here, but basically the request we got was $100,000 in funding for a three-year contract. I didn't receive information on what the money would be used for, whether it would be augmenting existing programming or whatnot, so I would invite Paul maybe to come up.
So just a question for the administration. When did you get the request?
Let me check right now. It was probably October, November. It was originally came through Commissioner Allman's office. It would have been before, right before the election, and then we met with Ground Up in her office, and then we met with them in my office in probably end of October, November. The lack of any committee or commission meetings in the month of November and December is what kind of prolonged this.
And Matt, a little bit of background for
I think the benefit of Commissioner Richardson, but just to refresh all of our recollection, what's the history of Ground Up with the city, and in the past, what has been our funding contributions to them, and then why is this different from what we've done in the past?
Sure. The City of Miami Beach proper has not funded any cash sponsorship. We do, the VCA, the Visitor Convention Authority, does a $28,000 grant to them because they do meet the hotel and the marketing requirements, so they get $28,000 from the VCA. Last year, the City of Miami Beach did an $11,000 fee waiver for fees and permit fees, and then I believe there's funding that comes from the county as well. So historically, this is year three, I believe, Paul. Year three?
This will be year four.
Apologies.
And it's in North Beach at the Bandshell.
And it's in North Beach at the Bandshell with the Rhythm Foundation as one of the supporters as well.
And so maybe Paul can tell us, but you can as well, Matt. So then why now are they asking for $100,000 when in the past they haven't? Because that's what we have to decide, whether this is an event that we want to invest, you know, 3 year, $100,000 per year commitment.
Right.
You know, what does the city get in return for that? And, you know, why now? Why hasn't been...
And that's
it's been asked for in the past.
Right, and that's the information I don't have, so I would invite Paul and the group to come up to say why in year four the $100,000 request is coming in when the city hasn't funded it previously. Again, for the record, great event. I don't think anyone's going to question that. My question would be, normally when we sponsor existing events, it's to augment in some way, to grow, to add programming. To add further benefits to education programs, to economic impact, small business improvement, free tickets for residents, whatever it may be. So I don't have the information on what the extra $100,000 would go towards.
So you just said it's a great event. Can you tell me what it is? I don't even know what it is.
Paul, why don't you come up?
Who's going to tell me what it is?
I'm happy to. Yep.
Okay.
So since it was deferred, I mean, do you want these?
Yeah, the mic. Up to the mic if you have handouts, you can hand them out.
Can we hand these out to you so you have it in front of you?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is actually the same thing I had given to Matt and would have been in front of you had we not been deferred. So first, thank you all for allowing us to speak, and I can explain to you what the urgency is, but let me first give you a little bit of history about the event. My name is Paul Lair. I am a third-generation Miami Beach resident, and I'm the CEO of Ground Up Music, which is a record label with David Crosby and Snarky Puppy and a number of other people. And because I'm a Miami Beach resident, when it was discussed with the founder, Michael League, where we should have this annual festival, I convinced him at first we should have it in Miami Beach. He agreed and said, well, we'll do the first one there, and then we'll move it around. And then I convinced him that we should do it here every year. When I first went in front of the VCA, I had no idea whether what I was saying was actually going to turn out to be true, where I said we expect that we're going to get a lot of people, a lot of tourists coming. As it turns out, we get about 63% of our audience from 48 states and 54 countries. So we're missing Oklahoma and Nebraska, and we're working on that. But literally, you know, if you look in the deck, we did one of those images where you look at, like, the airlines where they show all their routes, and we show all the countries from all around the world where people are coming for this event. So we think it's a great thing for the city of Miami Beach. We were very, very pleased and honored. Just in December, the New York Times listed us as one of the top 10 definitive moments of jazz music in the last entire decade. And they said this event in Miami Beach. So we're proud of what we can bring to Miami Beach, and more importantly, even to North Beach, which was the selection that I made as we looked around at different locations. So it brings in thousands of people each year. 63% are from out of state and out of country. We account for about 500 room nights on our own, just for our own staff and artists, you know, which originally we were at the Deauville, which was ideal because we could actually have everybody walk, and they had late night spaces. Then due to unfortunate circumstances where we lost a lot of money with the Deauville, which I'm sure we're never going to get back, we've had to move further and further down the street. They've been as accommodating as they can, but it's expensive to be in Miami Beach. The transportation's also an issue, so now we use the free trolleys and have everybody go back and forth with the free trolleys. But it's something that we really want to try and keep here in Miami Beach. The issue that we've now run into is we've gotten the support every year to the maximum extent possible from the VCA, but we are still losing money, and we're using our touring income from our other artists to support the event. You know, when we go through the financials, you'll see we're very lean. We do things as leanly as we can, but we also spend significantly more money to do the event the way we do it, which is, I don't know how many of you go to music festivals, but normally artists come in, they go to their trailer, they go to the stage, they go to their trailer, and they leave. We pay all of the artists a larger artist fee and to be here within the hotel and food the entire weekend. So instead, the experience you get is you're hanging out with Michael McDonald or David Crosby under a tree learning about songwriting. And on the last page of the second to last page of this, you know, NPR said Grounded was unlike any other musical event. Lines blur between artists and fan and spill onto Miami Beach because everybody is meeting and hanging out with the artists all of the time. So it's what made the New York Times call this one of the greatest events of the decade, but it also makes it more expensive. So we get the maximum support from the VCA every year, which we are indebted to and grateful for, and would not have been able to do this without them. We had also been planning on getting the $100,000 a year festivals grant from Michael Spring and the Dade County program. Unfortunately, I had misunderstood that, and you know, we have as our fiscal agent and production partner, the Rhythm Foundation, who is here with us with Benton, and I had understood that after 3 years of showing a successful program, we would be entitled to that, not entitled, we would be able to apply for that festival's grant, and from all indications I'd gotten from Michael Spring and the staff, we would be in line to get it. What I now just recently learned, which is what prompted my conversation with former Commissioner Aleman, is that needs to be with our own 501c3. We cannot do it through the Rhythm Foundation. So we have applied for in December our own 501c3 status. I'm told it will relate back to this year, but we now need another 3 years showing how we're going to do this before we can get the festival grant from the county. So we are just short on being able to support it. And the attention that I've got from our founder, Michael Lee, who lives in Spain, and there are a lot of other cities where this kind of music is more popular. You know, Atlanta, New Orleans, other places where we have been offered to go, but I'm trying to keep it here, but we need additional support in order to keep it here. In addition, we just need more locals to come. I know it's great for tourism that we're getting so many people from 48 states and 54 countries, but we also need to try and get locals to attend. So we met with Bill Talbert and his entire staff. You know, they got everybody around the table. They're going to take us on. They're going to try and promote us very actively to try and get more local attendance. But in the meantime, we just need support in order to be able to keep it here. And what I'm actually requesting is, I guess, a little bit of a modified request, unless everybody's ready to say yes for the 3 years, is to at least look at this first year for 2020, because that's the money that we need in order to be able to announce in February, which is in about a month from now when we're at the festival, that we're going to be able to remain here in Miami Beach. And that's important that we be able to do that at the festival, because if we can make that announcement at the festival, then we go on sale with the tickets at the festival and can capture about $80,000 to $100,000 from the excited festival goers who are there at the time.
So you have the money for this year's show. You're talking about next year's show?
No, we have the money in the sense that we're not going to default on any payments that we're going to make, but no, we're going to lose money again this year without this support, which is why we need this support.
So the funding will be for the 2020?
The funding will be for festival. The 2020.
So we'll know whether it was successful in exactly a month.
Well,
if we were to move forward, we would know at the end of the February weekend the outcome of, you know, your marketing and outreach efforts to bring residents.
Yes. I mean we get residents for all throughout the state, as well as all over the country and world. So we are ahead of where we've been last year, so I'm happy about that. I expect with you know, Bill Talbert and everybody else's outreach, or maybe not.
No, I mean, that organization is great, but they have another mission. They're not going to be able to mobilize to drive residents for a local, you know, music festival. I would
Do you have any other agencies that you've worked with or are working with to help drive attendance?
I mean, we have a small, you know, we have our small marketing team. We have ads placed with different, you know, with New Times and with Newtropic and with other things like that. So we're taking advantage of every resource that we have. But I'm not really sure how we crack this local nut of getting the locals to attend, because one of the things that we do, you know, we have these programs where all of the artists come in and do small workshops and master classes. So we invite the seniors in, we invite the students from all the schools and all the different programs, but it's not big flashy names. It's not Kygo. I mean, even, yeah, you know, I mean, those of us who are older sitting on the dais know who the Doobie Brothers and Michael McDonald is. But most people out there just don't. So it's hard for us in this EDM kind of world to convince the locals to come, but I still think it's something worthy of doing and continuing here in Miami Beach. And the people that it brings in, you know, we did get an additional donation this year from Paul Allen's foundation, Vulcan. Paul Allen would come every year. George Perez comes every year. The Estefans come every year. I mean, it's a great event that attracts people from all over, as well as South Florida, but it's just a slower process to bring in the locals. But for the musicians, everybody who looks at this says, this is the lineup. This is the musicians' musicians. You know,
if my colleagues will indulge me, yeah, let me try to tee this up how I think of this. First of all, I want to express my admiration to you, you know, for all that you do, you know, for our artistic community. I think this is a really nice festival. And I love that it's in North Beach and that you've been able to sustain it this long. And, you know, I wish you luck going forward. But as I think about this, there's a lot that I think about. One is that, you know, these music festivals take a while to get off the ground, right? And so whether it's the city or a big corporation, it needs seed money to you know, plant roots and then grow. But now we're heading into our fourth year, and we're being asked to provide you some money, and I want to have assurance that this can grow, that this isn't going to be, you know, you're going to come back next year, hat in hand, asking again, and I don't mind continuing to fund so long as it's continuing to grow and really get on the map, bringing tourists and residents out. And what I'm sort of seeing and gathering, talking to staff and others, that, you know, it's been 3 years of artistic success and critical success, but residents, it isn't resonating. So I think all of us are old enough to know who the Doobie Brothers are and David Crosby, but the fact that Commissioner Richardson, who lives in this community, didn't know about it means that the outreach isn't working. And so the question I have for you is your organization, you,
yes,
who, your board, your professional staff, if you can't deliver and grow this, then we're potentially giving you money that we might be able to give to somebody else that can do more with it. And so what I'd like to hear from you is a business plan on, you know, what are we going to do this year and, you know, a three-year plan on how we're going to grow this to address some of the issues you're having of audience attendance. And by the way, so that you can get yourself in a position where you can get good corporate sponsorship so you don't have to keep coming back to the city for that money. We could provide you seed money, but at some point we'd love to have AT&T or somebody be your Budweiser or somebody to be your big sponsor so that we can then take our $100,000 and give it to another organization so they can grow. So that's how I'm thinking, you know, about this.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I am certainly old enough to know who the Doobie Brothers and Michael McDonald are, but candidly didn't have much awareness of the event either. So just a data point. I also have great admiration for entrepreneurs. Realize what you're going through. Here's how I think about these generally, and then, you know, my sort of key points around this. First, I like to start with where are we today, the baseline, sort of both the pain and the gain. Are our residents enjoying it? Are we getting the economic benefits? I understand what I'm hearing our entrepreneur, Paul, represent, but, you know, from a city standpoint, can we document some of that, any traffic impacts, anything around that I'd like to know. Second, if we're going to spend more money, we'll know what we're going to get for it. Are residents going to come for free? Is there something for our children, some of the seniors? If we're going to write more money, I want to see the value specifically. And then, and I don't think we'll solve this today, though I think we have some items coming. Whenever we're writing one check here, that meant another check didn't go over here. And I think Commissioner, the chair mentioned that. What else could we be doing? So with that said, Matt, can you provide anything in terms of the baseline? Number of residents, true economic impact, something that went to the VCA, like how's it doing from our city's view?
Yeah, the VCA requirements for their grant for their $28,000 are just strictly hotel room and marketing impressions. So if you hit the threshold for those, then you get the $28,000 in funding. Personally, I know meeting with the organization had said that locally a lot of the residents aren't aware of this event, which is a little bit scary for us in terms of putting public funds into an event that people may not know about. And to Commissioner Ayola's point is, you know, in year four, we would hope to have a little bit of traction. It's generally year three when festivals kind of turn that corner and start to see a little bit of a profit. So in terms of the economic impact, I wouldn't know that. We haven't seen those numbers. We could probably look at what that is. I think for us, it's more the administration side of things is we don't know what the request is for. It's funding for funding, where it's normally we see kind of here's what the money's being requested for. You know, Seafood Festival, for instance, $25,000, they built a culinary education program, and they built a small business incubator program as part of their festival, so they grew it with the city funds. So it gets a little bit dicey for me when it seems like it's just a sponsorship request to keep going what's already happening, and what's happening seems like it's losing money. Yeah. So,
okay. If I could just follow up one more question. So, Paul, to those sort of basics, could you please describe how some set of money for 1 year would be used, and then what is the sort of value to the community? Again, something for the children, you know, free tickets. What would we look at the community and say, we spent this money and we got this?
Sure. So let me first off not give you the misimpression that the locals aren't attending. When 60% is coming from outside, that still means that 40% of the 6,000 people are coming from inside the community. And when you've got a list of artists that you have in front of you who most people have never heard of, other than the sole David Crosby or Michael McDonald, that's the tougher sell. Is to sell, you know, because what we're trying to do with this organization is give up opportunities to young up-and-coming artists who don't have that reputation. So we are getting actually traction, and the traction has been increasing every year. We've got several thousand from the local community who come, but yeah, as a benefit to the VCA and to the people who are interested in tourism and hotel rooms, we're also getting an unusually large percentage of people coming from all around the country and all around the world. In terms of the programs, we've already been doing the programs for free with seniors and kids with master classes and going into their schools and into the different programs as well as inviting them in. And one of the things, you know, that we had discussed with Matt, and I'm open to any suggestions, is what else we can do to open this up more to the community. We're always happy to do that and take other ideas in terms of how to make it of even more benefit. But we are all already trying to provide those benefits with, you know, the seniors and with the kids, primarily kids who are interested in music and music education. So, you know, Frost School of Music comes, Guitars Over Gun, YMU, Live Modern School of Music, you know, the different schools in Dade County. So we are already working with those organizations as well.
So I want to go move back a little bit and just try to get some of the basics, since I don't know your organization. So are you organized as a 501c3?
We're awaiting our IRS letter, so we applied for it, but we are not yet. But we expect to be relating back to December of this year, so this year will be our first year operating as a nonprofit. But before then, we've been working with the Rhythm Foundation as our fiscal agent. They are a 501c3.
Okay. But the Rhythm Foundation does a lot of events, so you yourself, you don't have any financial statements, do you?
No.
And Matt.
Yes, in order to get the grant money, we've got those, but from the VCA. So we've got the audited financial statements that we submit to the VCA every year.
But that's of the Rhythm Foundation?
That's not the Rhythm. The Rhythm Foundation is separate.
So
of our festival, yes, we do.
So you don't have a legal entity, though, because you have never, you're just applying for your 501c3, but you're saying you have financial statements for
the LLC.
So you have an LLC.
We are presently an LLC.
Okay.
We've applied for our 501c3. We have not received it yet.
Okay. So you have an LLC. It's a for-profit LLC. So you have financial statements. Are those financial statements audited or unaudited statements?
Audited
statements. And can you give us a general idea what your revenue was in the last operating period? Was it, you know, 100,000 or a million or?
It was, I'd say, about 450 to 500,000. Yep.
Okay. And how long have you been an LLC?
We established it for the purposes of this festival, so this will be.
So it's an LLC specific to this festival.
Yes.
Okay. And this will be the fourth year for the festival.
Correct. Yep.
Okay. And in the first 3 years, were you profitable? You made money. You lost money. Where did you come in?
We have lost money all 3 years, and we've supported the losses with our touring and other revenue from, you know, the artists who are on our label.
Okay, so you said this LLC, though, was specific to this particular festival.
Yes.
So how did you get the money for the other into this LLC? Did those other legal entities make some sort of contribution?
Yes, the founder of Ground Up, Michael League, is the owner of all of these different organizations, and so in essence, this is a project that we discussed, and as I mentioned in the beginning, where are we going to do this? Is it something we want to do? We convince him to do it in Miami Beach, and when it runs short, he just takes money from the other organizations and really his touring revenue, his personal revenue, and puts it into this to continue to sustain it. But what changed this year is he said, look, we can't continue to do it. We either need to get the support of the city and soon to be now the county, or we're going to need to move this to a location where there's a greater presence of jazz fans and other things like that. As I said, it was my miscalculation because I had thought we would be eligible after the 3 years, which I was aware of this grant, after the 3 years we would be eligible for the grant from the county, not realizing that we needed to be our own 501c3, not relying on the past 3 years through the Rhythm Foundation as our fiscal agent.
And how much over the last 3 years, how much money has this LLC lost and that you've needed funding from this other source to come in? So let's take last year, for example.
So
how much money did the LLC for this festival lose last year?
Last year, I believe last year and the year before were about the same, of about 150. The first year we actually started smaller, and it was about 40 or 50. And so that seems to be where we're at in terms of the funding, is about 150. So this year what we did is we trimmed every different possible expense that we could. Unfortunately, expenses have also gone up because of the hotel, because of the transportation, because it's no longer walking distance. And every year we actually have been doing this on Grammy weekend. And even the first year, our artist, Snarky Puppy, was winning Grammys as they were here on stage. So we had to move it. And with the crowded calendar in South Florida, with, you know, South Beach Food and Wine and Super Bowl and everything else, we really were sort of forced to pick this weekend, Valentine's Day weekend, where the hotels and flights are even more expensive. So we're doing everything we can to trim the expenses while keeping the integrity of the festival and the ethos, where you have the artists hanging out with everybody. And Commissioner Arriola, in response to one of the statements you made earlier, you know, when you walk around the festival, it is not the AT&T festival or the Budweiser festival, and we're doing that on purpose. You know, we had been approached by, as well as other cities, also larger organizations, AEG and Live Nation. When you do that, you start losing the creative control over what you can do at the festival, because Live Nation and AEG then tend to start basically telling you what artists they want to see in there, because those are the artists who sell more tickets. So, you know, we're trying to keep the artistic integrity, and we've seen the trend where we've gotten more and more locals coming, so we're pleased about that. We had anticipated, as I said, the grant from the county, and we're now starting, even with the 501c3 not in place, we did get $50,000 from Vulcan and Paul Allen's, and we expect that with the city's support, we'll be able to go out and attract other supporters. This is the first year, for example, that all of the stakeholders, the builders in the North Beach area, are all supporting us to a small degree, and they've all actually said, if you can get the city behind you so we know that you're going to be here and you're going to stay, we'll continue to support and we'll up our support.
So Michael League owns the Ground Up Music Festival?
Yeah, Michael yes. League is the founder of Ground Up, and he is the sole owner of all of the entities.
And the record label?
And the record label,
yeah.
Yep.
So of the artists that perform at the Pop Up Music Festival, I'm sorry, the Ground Up Music Festival, how many of those are on his label?
So the first year, which is also what made it actually less expensive the first year was everybody on the label. So everybody was there and supporting and not charging a significant fee. This year, so you've got about 20 artists on the label. First year was all of the artists. Second year was half of the artists. Third year and going forward, we're doing a third, a third, a third. So we're always going to have a third cycle through, with the exception of Snarky Puppy. I'm not sure if anybody's familiar with Snarky Puppy. They are a very large band in terms of size. There are about 20 different artists on stage, and they've got a huge fish, Grateful Dead cult-like following where people follow them around all over the world. So when they're playing in other places, you know, they're drawing 5,000 and 10,000 people to every show.
So what this sounds like to me, right, is so you've got the record label and their business. They want to have a festival to promote music, particularly exploit their artists, for the benefit of their record label, so you have a festival, which benefits the record label. The issue I have is then, you know, why is the city going to promote a festival that, you know, a lot of the benefit will go to the record label and the artists that they represent, when we could easily just put this $100,000 to another promoter or organization that could curate other artists that bring more people to our city, more heads in beds, create more economic vitality? Because you talk about Live Nation and AEG and stuff, and you know that, you know, the artistic integrity is somehow compromised. But I would argue that, you know, when you've got a curator like this who has a business interest in seeing his artists promoted, I think you also have that same tension. We're being asked to give you potentially $100,000. That's money that we're not giving to somebody else who might be able to do more with that. That is more consistent with what we're trying to do with the city, which is to promote North Beach, to bring arts and culture to our city. And what we're hearing from our staff is that this event, while it's good and has artistic merit and has critical acclaim, might not be delivering on the policy of this administration, which is to, you know, bring locals out to the North Beach area, you know, bring tourists to our town, et cetera.
So if I can address, actually, in order, all of the points. Yeah, sure.
Hi. Ben Galgay, the Director of Operations for the North Beach Band Shell, staff member of the Rhythm Foundation. I've been managing the band shell for the past 5 years, so just a few little pointers from my perspective there. We might be looking through the telescope backwards, right? All of the attention that this brings to Miami Beach is the attention that we just spent the last hour saying we want in Miami Beach, right? These are people that are coming here for arts and culture tourism. These are people coming to explore Miami Beach and everything it has to offer when they're staying in North Beach. They're going to South Beach. They're eating in our restaurants. They're staying in our hotels. So certainly in terms of the scale of the events that we've had at the band shell, this is, bar none, the largest event that we do each year. It is, whether or not we are looking under the hood right now, still considered the most successful event that we produce each year. Like he said, this is the one that gets all of the attention, whether it's local or international, of people saying, hey, what's new in North Beach? What's changing? what is taking place now. And so this is an opportunity for us to package what North Beach is in terms of the goals of the administration. It's our opportunity to be able to look at where we are today. It's not as much that there's a fiscal responsibility of that artist or label manager to have their artists on there. It actually is more coming from an onus of a conversation that Paul and I had years ago, where we were looking as the Rhythm Foundation, saying, how great is this that we have an opportunity where we can program the stage now, every day of the year? What if we went back to an artist and said, hey, you got more than a couple hours on the stage, but you're actually able to take this canvas and create something new, a unique product, right? So we're calling it a music festival, but it's not really. It's a cultural tourism destination for 3 days long that takes place in, you know, no offense, a blighted, a deemed blighted neighborhood in Miami Beach's communities, right?
So we haven't met before, and I'm the new kid on the block. That's also a group, but not as old as the Doobie Brothers. So could you just introduce yourself? And you said that you manage the band shell.
My name is Ben Galgay.
And you manage the band shell.
I work on behalf of the Rhythm Foundation. I've been the director of operations at the facility since we gained the management of the contract back in 2014. So, you know, year-round, my responsibilities include contracting all the events that take place, facilitating the productions, hiring all the vendors, making sure everything that's going on there is done in a successful model, managing the day-to-day business, and also the strategic implementation of capital improvements.
So just so I understand the relationships, Rhythm Foundation has, because I'm the new kid on the block, the Rhythm Foundation has the contract to manage the band shell, is that right?
Year-round.
Okay. And then this festival, the Rhythm Foundation is also involved in this festival, is that right?
Right, so that's correct. We act as a fiscal agent up till this point. We also are hired as a consultant with respect to production and marketing. One of the things that we do each year with Paul is work on the expansion of the site into the surrounding area and implement the special events process in coordination with the city as the Rhythm Foundation.
So I'm really uncomfortable with this, and so I need to say that. So I just got elected, I'm the new kid on the block, but I ran on a platform of accountability and transparency, and this fails the test for me. First of all, the proposal didn't come to the city until November, for whatever reason. I wasn't here when it came because I didn't get elected until the night of the 19th of November. But there's a process. And as my colleagues have said, when we're giving one entity money, that means we don't have the money for another entity. And so for me, I'm going to be consistent in my tenure at the city. And I'm going to treat everybody the same. And there needs to be a vetting process. The administration needs to vet all requests so that we can be fair across the board, because I don't want someone else coming in tomorrow and the next day asking for $100,000 with basically giving us a 3-month notice. It's not fair to us as individuals who have to vote, and it's not fair to the administration who hasn't had the time to vet this and brief us. So I'm not comfortable with this, and I think that the chair also touched on the fact that, you know, this is an opportunity for Roundup to really highlight their artists. And let me just finish, and then I'll let you respond. This is an opportunity for Roundup to highlight their artists, and you know, it wouldn't surprise me if there is a cost of an entity to do that, because there it's a marketing cost. And so to ask the city to put up $100,000 even for 1 year right now is just not something that I can't support, because when somebody else comes in the door tomorrow, I'm going to tell them the same thing. I want every request to be vetted. I want to be briefed on the return on investment for the city. I want to know, as Commissioner Samuelin said, how it's going to benefit our locals and so forth. So, you know, I'm sorry that I can't support this today, because, you know, it's raising all sorts of questions. And quite frankly, I'm also raised by the question that the fact that Ground Up is managing the band shell and you're here as an advocate for basically a festival where you've been the fiscal agent. And so also Commissioner Areola mentioned that oftentimes what you'll need is seed money the first year. What we've heard, and, you know, I'm an accountant and an auditor, and we've heard is that you had a smaller loss in the first year and then bigger losses in the second and third year. Now we're moving into the fourth year, and since you have no financial statements that are before us today, how do I know that you're not going to have an even bigger loss in the fourth year? So I would have expected maybe to have the bigger loss in the first year and then had more ticket sales and more momentum. So for those reasons, I can't support you today. You know, if you want to submit a proposal for next year and have it properly vetted through the city and have us briefed, then I'd certainly be willing to take a fresh look at it there. But today I can't support this for funding basically in a month. And also another point is that we don't have this in the budget. So we're going to have to take this out of our reserves. And I'm going to have to explain to the taxpayers why we're taking money out of reserves to pay for this. And I just can't do that today. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll just sort of echo a few of the comments. I appreciate the event. I appreciate that there's been some good things going on. But I think Commissioner Vice Mayor Richardson says it well. I'm sort of left wanting to know, what are the facts? And I appreciate how the facts have been represented, but I need to look at our professional city staff and say, you know, how much money was generated? Can we validate all this? How many residents are going? I need the baseline to make incremental decisions. I also would underline, and again, Vice Mayor said it very well, you know, we need a sort of holistic view across events. You know, we've got 100,000. Is this where it should go? Should there have been something else? We really need that big picture. And at the end of the day, I'm absolutely open to continuing the dialogue for 2021. If it was a 2021 discussion, I think we'd be rolling up our sleeves talking about, can we do this? And let's get a business plan. Get outside sponsors. Let's come together. And I would be open to that conversation, but not for something that's going to take place literally in a couple weeks.
I think this is the challenge that folks are going to have come before this committee with this kind of, you know, sort of lack of business plan. When you've got three MBAs, you're going to get scrutinized. And, you know, while I appreciate everything you've done, and I love promoting culture in our community. I think about what we're trying to do in North Beach. We've made a substantial investment in the Bandshell, and you know, by the end of this year, it's going to be magnificent. And the Ocean Terrace, renaissance that's about to occur, it's going to be a great place to have these kinds of festivals. But you've got a calendar. You only have so many weekends, and we only have so much money. We have to invest in the types of festivals that are going to be very successful. And what we're hearing is, for the past 3 years, this festival has sort of been limping along a little bit. And, you know, when we ask for very basic things like financial plans, financial statements, organizational things, what's your marketing, and you're saying, well, you're going to give it to the CVB, it doesn't give me as a businessman a lot of comfort that this is on the right trajectory. And so I support Vice Mayor Richardson's analysis of this. If you want to come back next year with a tighter business plan on where you're going to take this, you might have a more receptive audience. I am troubled by the fact that what I view to be a conflict of interest, where you've got a for-profit record label showcasing their artists in a festival, that's a marketing expense, and that's great. But to have the city and taxpayer money go pay for that marketing expense, I'm troubled by that.
If I can actually just address that one point. So there are actually, if you look at the top line, Alina, Magda, and Becca, those, and Breastfast, the one right below, those four are the only four artists from the label. And the way that the music business works now, they don't make any money from record sales or anything else. They're just having an opportunity to be on the stage because they're great artists. So this really is not a marketing expense. The only way you make money in music now is live touring. And so they're out packed in their vans going across the country. But this absolutely is not, you know, some way to try and line the pockets of the artists of the label. That's not what it was for. And in terms of whether or not it's successful, we do actually have a marketing plan, which I'd be happy to share, and the business plan, which I'd be happy to share. The way that this came before this committee was sort of as a surprise to me. Originally, I had understood it was going to be before this committee being presented by Matt, and then I found out just a couple days ago it wasn't. It was going to be deferred, and then I found out last night, literally as I was on my way to a trip, that I was going to be presenting this morning, so I took the 6 a.m. flight to come back and present. I'd be happy to share all those other materials with you, but there are, in fact, marketing plans, marketing spends. In terms of measuring success, you know, this is, I would say, in all respects, in terms of support from the city, incredibly successful. It is bringing thousands and thousands of room nights every year to the city and to the economy, and it's bringing people literally from 48 states and 54 countries. So in terms of making Miami Beach more of an arts and cultural destination, I would say that this is very successful in doing that, and you've got the accolades not only from the Miami Herald, which features us on the cover every year, and the New Times, but also Rolling Stone and NPR and the New York Times talking about what a great event this is. So in terms of actually establishing Miami Beach in arts and culture, as well as bringing significant revenue to the city, that's something that I think should be considered when you're deciding where you put your money. Is this bringing value to the city? And I think because of those two factors, it certainly is. And then again, the third point with respect to offering programs to the young students and to the seniors and others, we've already been doing that, and we would be continuing to do that and open it up to any other ways where, you know, the commissioners or Matt thought would be appropriate. But at least wanted to address those concerns.
I want to move on. I think you're not going to get the support you need. But, you know, just to be clear, so Michael League is the founder of Snarky Puppy. He owns the record label. He owns the festival. His band is the headliner act that drives most of the attendance.
Correct.
And so, as I understand it, because they're not necessarily touring as they have in the past.
No, they're touring worldwide.
Yeah, but I'm saying, as I understand it, in prior years, Miami was a stop along that tour?
No.
No?
No, they come here specially every year, and they basically don't charge the festival for their services. So when they're out, they're playing for much higher fees. One of the ways that we were able to actually make this work is, since they're such a headline act and they don't charge their normal fee, you know, we're getting a lot of people coming because they come for Snarky Puppy. But yes, they're on a world tour right now.
But I understood that there was something different this year with respect to their tour, that their record label was not going to cover the expense of this stop.
No, I'm not sure what they're on tour now. They're not planning on touring the next year. He's going to be writing and working with other artists. He produces artists, so he's going to be writing and producing. But no, they're presently on tour right now.
Okay. Then I'm misinformed. I heard that part of the reason there's a $100,000 gap was because something related to the tour. But nevertheless, I mean, it's still the same owner of the festival, record label, band. It's all sort of the same entity.
And also the same entity that's managing our band shell.
No,
different.
Yeah. No.
No, the ground up.
No.
No, it's not.
The Rhythm Foundation is a 33-year-old 501c3 established by James Quinlan.
But the Rhythm Foundation has been funding your organization, providing funding, no?
No. They have the contract for the band shell.
Yeah.
The band shell's put on programs for years. I guess 5 years they've had the contract at the band shell. And we looked around at different looked around at different locations for where we were going to do this festival. We started off in downtown Miami. We looked at, you know, at the Gusman there, at different places, and then selected the band shell, and North Beach is the place that we wanted to do the festival. They are the ones who run the band shell. So they have been assisting us with – they're basically a production partner.
So I must have
funding it 100%.
I must have misunderstood them, because when we talked about your LLC and the shortfall – that was being funded by another organization, I thought, maybe I misunderstood, that you said that the Rhythm Foundation had put in money to your LLC to make up the difference. So what was the entity that put in the money to make up the difference that you told me? You said that you were short, you lost money, and there was an LLC that was an entity that put in money to your LLC to make up the difference.
So Michael Lee, I don't know where it came from, Michael Lee.
Okay. So it's the same principle. It may not be the same legal entity, but it's the same principle.
But the Rhythm Foundation's not associated with this.
But Mike Lee.
Organizational group at all. Michael League is the principal musician, singer, songwriter from Snarky Puppy. So everything that we've discussed in terms of the festival, the record label, and the touring, that's okay. All independent to that artist.
Mm-hmm.
Like Paul had mentioned, the Rhythm Foundation's been based in Miami Beach since 19 for 33 years.
So if I can, Mr. Chair, I think the chair said it doesn't sound like you have the support this year from this body. So we would welcome you to continue working with the administration if you want to submit a proposal. You basically got a little more than 12 months for next year, so it can be properly vetted. We can get all your financial statements, all your marketing plans, and we'd be happy to take a look at that, put it through the process, the same process that we'll put everybody else through, and so we'll have consistency here at the City of Miami Beach.
Yeah, I would echo that.
Motion.
Just if I could. I think it provides an opportunity really to document some of the things which you laid out in good faith and show what happened and then bring that as the business case for us to do incremental funding. And just one idea off the shelf, I don't know the price ticket and I think we're moving on, but maybe something significantly discounted for Miami Beach residents could make it attractive.
Sure, happy to do
and,
that.
And if I could, I'll just add one thing. I remember at my time at the state, I would often have people coming and asking me to help them get an appropriation from the state of Florida. And so my first question was always going to be, show me your financial statements and show me how the state is going to participate in your ask rather than be 100% funder. So I will tell you that I'm a very, very big supporter of helping people that are helping themselves, and I'm not a big supporter of providing 100% funding. So I will just say that you're not asking for that today. I know that. But I'm just saying that when you make your proposal, I would encourage you to show how there are independent private sources of funding and that the city would just be adjunct and supplemental to that. So that's something that's very important to me.
That's the case, and happy to show you.
Thank you.
All right, we still have a bunch to cover. We've deferred items 5 and 13. Who's here? Joe, what brings you here? Are you just watching? Or do you have an item? Huh? Oh, okay, let's do that. I'm sorry. Why don't we do the IG ordinance so Joe can go about his business? Who's presenting?
John and I were going to present the item.
It's item number 8.
Mr. Chair, if I could. This is a follow-up to passing on first reading. We've had some very productive discussions within the administration. We took feedback from first reading as well. The Geobond Committee has reviewed it. I think what we have is a shared view from the city attorney, the IG, and the administration of what we should do, which I'm supportive of as well.
And if I may briefly, at first reading, we've incorporated the comments that Commissioner Richardson and Commissioner Areola provided, specifically to make clear, as you mentioned, Commissioner Richardson, that if the intent here is for the IG fund to be an exclusive dedicated fund, then the ordinance should provide that. And so we've now updated the ordinance with language to that effect. And then to address Commissioner Areola's comments that this is a funding source and a funding mechanism, but does not provide for any entitlement for expenditures. And the IG, under the ordinance that you previously adopted with the powers and duties of the Inspector General, already requires the Inspector General to submit to the annual budget process and to go through that regular budget process and provide whatever level of detail is applicable for other departments. But we have clarified here in the IG ordinance that that nothing in this ordinance is authorizing any expenditure of funds except as approved by the City Commission pursuant to the budget process. So that would address your comments at first reading. After first reading, the item was heard by the GO Bond Oversight Committee, and the committee expressed a concern for the impact of the assessment of an IG fee for larger projects. The proposed fee has now changed, and John is going to get into that in a second. But at the time, the committee was responding to a proposed fee of 1.5%. So for your larger projects, in such as, say, the 72nd Street Civic Complex, that's over $50 million, that alone would be a $750,000 impact just for one project. And so we took the feedback and worked with Commissioner Samuelin, the sponsor, and finance has evaluated the numbers better, and John will get into that, so that we could minimize scope impacts to projects while still accomplishing the intended purpose of the ordinance, which is to essentially to cover the general fund portion of the IG's budget, which approximates $1.5 million. And so with that, I'll let John go through the way that the contract allocation has changed and the percentages.
Yeah, so we had an opportunity to spend more time analyzing the fee. If you think about it, it touches all the city's contracts, so the scope of it is very large. And what we found is when we looked at the capital side of the equation that we had a little more work to do, and so we scrubbed that. And what we found is that we're able to lower the percentage from 1.5% to 0.5%, and that a cap is very important for some of these bigger projects, like I think Rafael mentioned the 72nd Street Complex, you know, where we have a potentially $50, $60 million construction contract. But with that analysis, I think we were able to show that we can still generate the $1.45 million or so that we're shooting for here to cover the general fund expense. And so the long and short of it is that we adjusted the percentage down, and we're recommending a cap just to protect the budgets of some of these big capital projects. And we feel like it still will generate the amount of money we're looking for, and that we can always look at this after we have 2 or 3 years' worth of experience and always adjust, make an adjustment if necessary. Just to be clear, we fully funded the OIG's budget in the budget this year. This, any revenue that would come in as of implementation starting in April and the rest of the fiscal year would basically just supplement that. And then with that in hand, as we look at next year's funding, we would see how much of the general fund side of the budget we could lower, but we can always keep it the same, you know, so there's no downside here in terms of at least providing full funding for the office.
How are we going to account for the funds that come in? Are we going to, is this going to be set in a trust fund, or just we're just going to have a sub-ledger as part of our financial statements?
Good question. We're going to create a separate fund so that it's perfectly transparent, and I'm sure the OIG will be looking at that to make sure that those transactions are being done correctly. So, yes, it's going to be a standalone fund.
And, Joe, have you looked at this? Can you give us your comments? Are you comfortable with it?
Yes, Joe Centurino, Inspector General. I appreciate the fact that John and Rafael have kept me in the loop on this, and we've discussed it. And I'm fine with the changes. I think they addressed the issues that the commission had. And the reality is we're going to have to monitor this year by year and see, you know, how it works out. And I'm sure that, you know, if we need to make adjustments, we certainly can. But as a starting point, I'm comfortable with it.
Good. Yeah, so I'll make a motion to move it.
Great. Second.
Yep.
Done.
Thank you.
Okay. We have item number 2, which was mine. Discussion to explore ways the city can assist the housing authority here in the city to create affordable and workforce housing. Maria, are you going to present this?
Good morning. We have Mr. Michael Hare from the Housing Authority who is here and can provide, I think, some of the responses to the questions that were raised at the prior meeting.
Yeah, nice to see you again. We had a really good meeting back, I think, when was that, October, November?
Yeah, it was a great discussion.
Yeah. Where are we at now? And I think maybe for the benefit of Vice Mayor Richardson, if you want to bring us up to speed on what we're talking about here. We left it, as I recall, last time. One of the big sticking points was trying to figure out what we're going to do with the sort of the parking space ratio and some of the pros and cons. Where are we now on all of this, and what direction do you need from us?
Okay. Just for the new member, the Housing Authority, the City of Miami Beach. Well, my name is Michael O'Hara. I'm Director of Housing Development for the Housing Authority, City of Miami Beach, 200 Alton Road. The Housing Authority owns several vacant lots in the North Beach area on South Shore Drive and also on Marseille Drive. Commissioner Alleman had asked the Housing Authority in what ways could the City of Miami Beach assist the Housing Authority in development of affordable workforce housing on those lots. The Housing Authority and Commissioner Alleman came up with two significant ways that the city could assist the Housing Authority. The first was a waiver of any city-related fees. That was discussed at prior meetings. The Building Department said they couldn't waive building permit fees, but the Planning Department said that concurrency and related fees there could possibly be waived. So I think we need the committee to move that recommendation ahead so we can get the fee waiver. The other was regarding parking. The number of units in any development is primarily impacted by the number of parking spaces that can be provided. Currently, the zoning code requires 0.5 parking spaces per unit. The Housing Authority recommended that the city adopt a 0.25 parking spaces per unit. At the last meeting, we had a number of residents that live in the South Shore Drive area. So kind of just going to throw out an idea to the committee. We don't want what we're trying to accomplish in North Beach be impacted by this kind of parking relationship. The Housing Authority is going forward with its partner Housing Trust Group on developing those properties using that 0.5 parking requirement that's currently in the code. So we have approximately 94 units that could be built on South Shore Drive, and we would be providing about 50 parking spaces, so at that 0.5 level. So the Housing Authority is not going to develop South Shore Drive with zero parking, but I think there's an opportunity at other lots citywide, not just that the Housing Authority has in North Beach, that perhaps if you wanted to have zero parking for lots that were less than 14,000 square feet or projects that had less than 25 units, something like that. But the number of units that's going to be developed is directly tied to the number of parking spaces that can be provided. So for instance, if you could only provide 30 parking spaces and the requirement is 0.5, your max is 60, even if you have excess FAR. So maybe you could potentially fit an extra 5 units, which is beneficial to everyone, but because that parking requirement is at 0.5, you can't do it.
Thank you for coming back. And I do think that parking was a critical area, so I want to focus on that. Do we have an analysis, and this is probably more directed to the city administrator, do we have an analysis of that area, parking utilization, something that we could sort of hang our hats on? How big is the issue of parking today?
Good morning, Commissioners. Carmen Sanchez, Planning Department. We don't have the data as far as the particulars of parking and the demand. We can reach out to the Parking Department and find out for you. But I just want to clarify two things. First of all, parking is exclusive. So FAR is not necessarily affected by parking. It's not included. It's not counted in, when you do your calculations for FAR. So if it's required parking, it's not, it doesn't affect your FAR ratio. The second thing that I wanted to point out is we will be recommending not necessarily a waiver of the fees, but rather a modification to address affordable housing or workforce housing or however the commission feels that should be applied, but not necessarily a waiver of the fee, but rather establishing a reduction for those uses.
Okay. So I think that analysis would be helpful. That was really the neighborhood concern around parking. The other thing we talked about was a specific idea, and it was related to, because the notion was not everyone was going to need parking. And I think we asked if you would be willing to build that into the lease. So if folks aren't going to use the parking, then we wouldn't have it. Interestingly, the Wall Street Journal reported November 19th, 2019, a new Arizona development has residents, and they're not going to bring cars. So is that something that we've pursued at all, and would we do that?
I have the Arizona article as well. I read through it. That's a 1,000-unit development. That's a whole neighborhood. So that's not what the Housing Authority is talking. The Housing Authority is talking to buildings on South Shore Drive, a small building on Marseille Drive. So there's really no parity between the Arizona project, which is an entire – it would be the equivalent of Midtown, Miami, all of that development, 1,000 units.
No, I understand, but, if I may. I understand yeah. It's different, but the question was, could we do it? That was the legal question. Could we legally pursue having people not bring cars? And it looks like that is legally defensible, at least for this development.
Well, I think the administration and the city attorney's office have had some discussions about that. That doesn't look like that would be an allowable thing that could happen.
The city's housing consultant, Hope, was of the opinion that making a requirement of no parking for this project and not any other project would be discriminatory and would raise a fair housing issue. The question would be, how do you institutionalize it to make sure that it's has parity across projects? But their issue was that by picking this particular project and demanding no parking, whereas other projects of similar size did not have that requirement, you are, in fact, discriminating against affordable housing.
So for the benefit of Commissioner Richardson, at least on the South Shore project, one of the tensions is it's an area that is really struggling with parking in general. You have a lot of multifamily dwellings that bump up against single-family neighborhoods, and because inadequate parking in those multifamily buildings, some folks are parking in the single-family district so much so that they literally had to erect a fence between the two neighborhoods, which certainly doesn't look good. And so in order to move forward with this project, we need to determine what a parking ratio would look like. We need more workforce housing units in the city. In order to do that, one of the things we would do is modify the parking ratio. But if we lower the parking ratio, then if people bring their cars, even though we tell them not to, where are those cars going to go? And the single-family neighborhood is very concerned that it's going to go into their neighborhood. The question I posed last time, and this really isn't so much an issue for you, but maybe for us, if the goal of the city is to build more workforce housing units, how best and where do we put that? I'll just speak my mind. I don't know that we need to necessarily put the workforce housing units in this location. This is a highly desirable location. It's on the golf course. What would be the fair market value of this property if we were to sell that for fair market value, however much money that would bring, and then reinvest that money in another part of our city where it's closer to mass transit, and we could build more units? Are we better off going in that direction than trying to, fit housing in an area where we're going to create a lot of tension? That's a question maybe to resolve this issue that we're struggling with here.
Okay.
Do you have comments on that? I know that's sort of outside of your sandbox, but that's how I'm thinking about it. I don't know what the fair market value of this would be, but I think
at the last memo a letter to commission LTC, we gave the appraised values of all the sites.
Do you recall what that was?
At least three times what we paid for it.
And so my thought is, and maybe we do a financial analysis and bring it back, which is if we were to think, however many millions that would be, we get that back at the city, we either go buy a building or build a building either on our own or as a P3, how many more units could we build at some other site Okay. With a lower parking ratio.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I need to just clarify a point. The land is not owned by the City of Miami Beach. It's owned by the Housing Authority of the City of Miami Beach. So
what would be the legal mechanism to trigger a sale?
I believe their board would need to approve
sale. Their board, that's appointed by us, right?
I believe so, but yeah.
Right.
But
so I understand the legal mechanism. There's a way to get to where I'm going.
Right, there was just some clarification needed.
I'm jumping ahead. So the Housing Authority owns it. We appoint that board.
Well, the mayor appoints the commissioners.
Don't be difficult with me.
What's being said, but I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
But again, the Housing Authority is going forward with development using the current parking code that's in place now, 0.5 spaces.
Right, but you can't make a decision without us, so it's the same thing. We're trying to be on the same team here, so just work with me. Right, why are you here?
Well, we're here because Commissioner Aleman had asked, how can the city assist? Two ways.
Right, and I'm trying to answer that question. How can the city assist? Build more workforce housing units in this city.
Right.
You're coming here to ask us to lower parking ratio to help you build more units, and we're telling you we're going to have difficulty doing that.
Right. So that's why I came up. Yeah. I understand, and the Housing Authority wants to be good neighbors wherever it is, and if we point to the three projects that we have in South Point, I think everybody in the South Point community would agree that the Housing Authority is the best neighbor to have and of the highest quality project. But on South Shore Drive, what I came up with earlier was trying to bifurcate the issue. South Shore Drive, 0.5 spaces, enough of spaces to accommodate what would be built there. But on other projects throughout the city, less than 14,000 square feet, or a project that would have less than 25 units would have a zero parking.
Yeah, how long have we owned this land?
Since
2014. No, correct me. How long has the Housing Authority owned this land?
2014.
Yeah, so, right, when I was running for office, I remember seeing this land vacant, and we're still here. We haven't done nothing. We have an urgent need for workforce housing, and we're just continuing to kick the can down the road. I'm trying to find an out for us here, because we're going to get tremendous tension from that single-family neighborhood if we lower the parking ratio, and we will not fulfill our policy of increasing workforce housing units unless we find...
Understood. That's why I'm trying to say, let's leave it alone on South Shore Drive. We're at 0.5. Don't reduce any parking requirement on South Shore Drive. I'm talking Marseille Drive, citywide. Reduce it for a lot that has 14,000.
Do we have data for your other buildings about, in terms of how many... residents have cars? I mean, what's the history? You mentioned the South Point buildings, for example. Do we have data points?
We're at 0.5 spaces in South Point. Rebecca Towers, we're at 0.25 spaces.
Well, no, that's what you built. I'm saying, what's the demand? Do we know, is the demand greater than that or less than that?
About that, in and around that number. We don't have huge waiting lists for
So, for example, you said
spaces.
Rebecca Towers is 0.25?
Yes.
And is there a waiting list?
Very minor.
Okay.
Handful of cars.
So with the,
because they're seniors.
Yeah, of course. So with the South Shore, then if they're not asking for a waiver there or any change,
right,
then you could move forward with that project, right?
Absolutely. Legally. That's our plan.
And is there any indicator that there is a need greater than 0.5? That is going to then cause more cars to come into the neighborhood, to spill over into the residential neighborhoods?
No. And I think there's been testimony from the planning department that having parking spaces in a project equals more cars. And it's a hard concept to wrap your head around, but no parking eventually leads to no cars. And it's a very hard concept to wrap your head around. But having parking spaces increases the use and the likelihood of cars. And that's something that's happening nationwide. But if you look to Portland or Seattle, they have it where they limit this
the no parking requirement to smaller size projects, so it doesn't have an impact on the neighborhood.
So the lots that the commissioner mentioned that were vacant in 14 that you've got a plan for that you're not seeking any waiver. What's the plan that you've got? You're going to move forward?
We have been moving forward. The Housing Authority has selected the Housing Trust Group. We've had three applications thus far go into Florida Housing Finance Corp. Unfortunately, they weren't selected for funding, and we have a fourth one that's in the selection process now. We should know by February.
Of this year.
All these projects are financed through the Florida Housing Finance Corp, and it's a competitive process that everybody applies against each other statewide for the funding.
So South Shore Drive, you project 90 units there between the lots, 40 and 50?
Approximately, yeah.
Why do you think that you said you had three and they didn't express an interest? Why do you think that they did not come to fruition?
The applications?
Well,
maybe I could address that. This is highly competitive funding, and it is probably the greatest source of funding for projects. Typically, projects that have to be hit the 100-unit threshold before they're even given serious consideration. It's a highly competitive pool of funds.
Because whoever's investing, even though it's workforce housing, is still looking to return a profit, right? They have to.
You need to meet the terms of the bonds, the 9% tax credits that are issued for those.
Okay. And the part of the scoring criteria is the amount of funding requested per unit. And that's why when we had spoke with Commissioner Alleman, any way that you can bring down the total project cost would be a benefit in the scoring criteria. But all the Housing Authority applications met the threshold, and it comes down to a lottery. Everybody is equal when they go in after scoring, and then a lottery number is assigned. So if you don't have a lottery number of 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, you're out. And unfortunately, the way the ball bounced, we were in the 40s, 50s, you know, every time the lottery came out.
Literally, it's just a lottery, so we just...
Yes. Yep.
It's highly competitive. There's not enough money out there for the number of people who are interested in this type of funding.
But you said something about 100 unit minimum to be...
Usually, you're looking at project sizes 100 unit above get the money.
That.
Yeah, below, it's a lot harder to reach that. The other point that perhaps you might want to edify the commission on is that your most latest application was actually for elder housing,
for
not workforce housing.
Right, for 118 units.
So speak to that then, because that would be over 100.
That included the site that we have on Marseille Drive. So it was three sites to get us over the 100 threshold.
I'll tell you where I come down on this. I mean, it just seems worth exploring. We sell this land, we take that money, or I should say the Housing Authority takes that money, and then you buy a building, you know, closer to mass transit where we can get more units. Maybe that helps us get the financing we're looking for, and then we create more units, which is what our policy is to create, whether it's elderly housing or workforce housing. You know, I know we own this land, but it's part of the real estate development. I mean, you move things around. I mean, this is a challenged property because it's not that close to mass transit. You got to walk. I forget what we said, but it's a good long quarter mile walk to get to the trolley.
It's over a quarter mile.
Doesn't work for elderly. They can't walk that far in the hot sun. You know, you need to be right at a stop for this to work. And as we think about planning our city, if we're going to have workforce housing, it's got to be close to mass transit hubs. And so, you know, this is an opportunity for us to possibly put a stake in the ground, you know, somewhere in our community where we're close to trolley stops, bus stops, and build, instead of 90 units, 120 units.
Yeah, I like that.
It's just, where would that be? This is the business we're all in. The largest vacant sites in the whole entire city, except for any kind of oceanfront parcels, are these parcels on South Shore Drive.
You can buy a building, no? And retrofit it?
Of course, they're occupied. And then, you know, you look at numbers, the type of properties that
we would buy for that purpose, you would categorize as naturally occurring affordable housing. So you would be taking those units away, displacing those people to have low. There would be no gain. There would be actually a net loss.
I mean, if you redevelop a site, you know, real estate developers do this all the time. You buy a building and, you know, you add, you know, to it, or you retrofit it. You know, you get more units out of it. I mean, I'm just, there are ways to do this. You don't have to start with raw land. You could buy a building and do something with it.
You can the one of the
assuming
expensive,
you have FAR to do it, you could do something.
One of the expensive pieces of purchasing a building, which we experienced when we acquired the Biscayne Beach house, is that we have to pay URA, which is 48 months and relocation expenses for tenants. So the larger the unit building that you purchase, that the greater the exposure and that amount is, and that is sizable.
I think this is. Just to be fair to everyone, I think this is a discussion that, you know, we need to continue to have relating to parking and the requirements. But I do think if we can move the other issue ahead on fee reductions or fee waivers ahead to the City Commission, that would at least help us in the meantime while we kind of come to some agreement on parking.
Can somebody explain that? What specific is?
And if I may, on the issue of the fee reductions. As Carmen mentioned, we wouldn't recommend waiver of fees, and Tom doesn't recommend that, Raul doesn't recommend that, but certainly you could reduce the fees. And in 2019, for the concurrency fees, the City Commission created an incentive area that already reduces the mobility fees for all projects north of 63rd Street by 62.5% until 2022. And then there's a sliding scale reducing the fee reduction until 2025. So the applicant would have the ability to benefit from that right now. Now, if you want to amend it further and reduce the fees further, then that would be an amendment to Chapter 122, and we can either keep it in committee and bring it back for you to review, or just commence the amendments to the LDRs to accomplish that.
Can you just give me some more in terms of what the fees are, what's the total amount, and how's it calculated, that sort of thing, just so I have some more information?
The parking fees are going to be, so if you're just talking about parking fees or mobility fees, we would have to look at the projects themselves, so I wouldn't be able to give you a number right now. But again, is what, you know, Rafael has mentioned. We would not recommend a waiver. It would be a reduction, and we would actually recommend that you apply to it across the board, not just project-specific. So if something is coming in with a category of affordable or workforce housing, then maybe you do a reduction based on those categories rather than just an outright waiver where you're incentivizing one project over another.
So can you just frame it in terms of how much money we just hypothetically we could be talking about?
We can come back and give you those numbers. We can share that with Maria so that she can bring you an update for this particular project.
Are we talking about a reduction in the ballpark of $100,000, $1 million, $10 million, $20? Just give me a ballpark. What are we? I'm just trying to frame how big of an issue. If we're talking about $10,000, obviously we don't want to spend a lot of time. If we're talking about $10 million, we do.
Well, it's not 10,000 or 10 million. It's somewhere in between. More likely, you know, in the hundreds of thousands, depending on the size of the project. But again, I will be uncomfortable giving you a number right now, just kind of off the top of my head. I don't know exactly what the impact is going to be, and therefore what the reduction would be. So we will be more comfortable coming back to you with a more precise number.
All right, why don't we have you come back next month with that information?
We'll share that with Maria so she can bring it back to everyone. We'll still be supporting the thought of reducing the fees, but again, it'll just be more realistic for you.
On the South Shore Drive, I just want to be clear because we're talking about we're using the term workforce housing, but you know, I see us applying for funding for low-income housing tax credits and things like that. I mean, are we talking Section 8 going here, or are we talking about true workforce housing for the South Shore project?
The first three applications were for what's workforce housing. The state changed their terminology. So the terminology years ago was either you were building a family project or you were building an elderly project. So they changed it from, they kept elderly, and then now it's workforce. So it's people that are in the workplace that have some income. And that's what the applications were for at the beginning. So, but the way that the Housing Authority is looking at this with its partner and the board, any available funding that comes up, the Housing Authority is applying for. It just happened to be that the first three applications were for workforce, this fourth one is for elderly, and then that's why we're going in for an elderly project. But the next one after this is for workforce again. So if the Housing Authority and its partner is not successful for that funding, then it goes to the next pot. So the pots keep moving, and it's a moving target that you have to be constantly in the hunt in order to apply.
Do you have zoning for that type of facility? I'm looking at the map. Those are, I thought, pretty much all single-family homes in that area, or am I in the wrong address?
I think you're
in
the wrong address.
This way is single-family, this way is multifamily.
This is multifamily, but
they abut.
They start blending.
Yeah, they blend.
On Ray Street is the dividing line on South Shore Drive. So to the west of Ray Street is single family, and to the east is multifamily.
So I think for next month, let's if you could actually get us something before the meeting, get us some rough estimates. You know, I just need to know what we're talking about. If we're going to be talking about fee reductions, what the fiscal impact's going to be, so we can just have a rough order of magnitude. That'd be helpful.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I would like to hear from the city attorney's office at the next meeting regarding, not just for this project, it's a very straightforward question, can building owners have a policy where tenants opt in and not bring cars?
We'll look at that.
Okay. Yeah, and then also what would help, and I think what threw the conversation a little bit candidly, is the recommendation in the memo was to reduce the parking requirements.
Yeah.
So I... You know, a lot of my thinking and preparation was based on that request. But if I heard you right today, that's not necessarily what we want to do. That
I'm just trying to help. I'm just trying to help and be a good neighbor to try and bifurcate South
Shore
Drive.
I appreciate that. But, we all, and I think I speak for my colleagues, put a lot of time and attention focused in preparation, and we focus on the key issues. So that's the fundamental issue. And if it changes in front of us, That really shifts the dynamic. So I would just ask for the next meeting that the conclusion be very clear about what the ask is.
Sure. All right, let's move on. Thank you. Let's do item number 7. And I think, Commissioner Samueling,
sure.
You're one of the sponsors of this. This is an update and status review of the Fairway Park Improvement Project. John, you want to tell us what's going on here? I read the memo, and I've got some comments, but why don't you brief us?
Sure. Yes, this project's been around for a few years. It started as a playground project, then an artificial turf project, and it grew into almost like a park master plan, including how do we live with water, both on site and in the neighborhood. So we lost the momentum. We have the momentum back. We've been working with the community. They'd like the project to start in June. That's hotter. The kids don't use the playground as much. So we are on track to break
ground. Let me challenge that statement, because it's one of the points I had when I read the memo. Is that true? I mean, that's when kids are out of school. I mean, I know it's hot, but kids don't care. They like playing even when it's hot.
I can tell you that came directly from the community leader who has been meeting with the city on this item. That did not come from the administration. So we're following the will of the...
I mean, my son's out of school in the summer, and he's in the park every day. I mean, so that was one of the concerns I had. We're going to shut it down in the summer. Is that when the kids are going to play? I mean, I know it's hot, but kids don't mind.
I can tell you that was the request, but if the timeline we're on, the phasing, it would fall in that June-July time
anyway.
Is it
a request from a parent?
Yes.
Yeah. But that's a big difference, right? The parent doesn't want to be in this heat. Doesn't mean that the kids mind.
Yeah, I can't comment
but
on
you're,
that.
You're request. A parks director. I mean, parks are used in the summer by kids.
Parks, my beach are used year-round.
Year-round.
Yeah, And it is warmer, and we do have some drainage issues at that playground. So considering it's the rainy season, it does make sense, but I can't disagree with you. You have kids in school 6-7 hours
well,
a day now.
Where I'm going to go with this is that would start in June. Forget the summer thesis. Can we start it sooner?
I don't believe we could start sooner than June.
Okay.
No, we're going through a fit. We don't have enough funds to do the entire project as it is today. So we're looking at, we're working to phase it now to go out to bid for a phase project.
The memo didn't provide the financial gap. What is the financial gap if we wanted to try to take care of this all at once? Because I know that the recommendation is to phase it, but if we wanted to, you know, just close a park, get it all done, and then open it and be done with it, what would that cost?
One moment.
And there's no geo bond money for this one?
No, sir. Oh, yes. Oh, it's a small portion. It's to do the perimeter fence and pavilion paint. It's a very small amount, $200,000. David, do you know the gap, at least from the old projections?
David Gomez with the Office of Capital Improvements. There was a time when we were looking at close to $1 million gap. We've been able to narrow that through some revisions in design and some cost savings measures, but we're looking at $500,000-$600,000 in gap.
Gap, yeah. And we didn't include this in the geo bond because
I don't think we have the that geo bond list went so many revisions. I don't want to comment on the record because we do have the fence and the pavilion. The gap may not have existed at the time of the GOB scope.
Okay. All right. So what's the work to be done, and what do you need us to opine on?
Well, right now, this I believe is referred to committee as a result of one of the residents reaching out about concern about the delay and wanting it phased.
The delay, and just the recommendation that we phase it so we get something going.
Correct. So I'm here to give you the status, the timeline that there was a delay, but we're projected to break ground in June, and we are going to phase it as requested by the community.
So this is for artificial turf, some drainage, and playground equipment?
Phase one would be the playground, including the drainage, some renovations to the pavilion. We're going to do an ad alternate in the bid that if we could get further, if our budget will allow us to go further into the park, including the basketball and tennis courts, we will. But we definitely do not have the funding to touch the artificial turf or anything in that sector of the park.
But we think to do the whole project, there's a gap of, what you say, 600?
It's south of $1 million, but it's up there. Yeah, there's a significant gap.
This irks me tremendously, as you know, because this should have been in the geo bond. And, you know, fortunately, I was able to push to get funding for these smaller parks. But, you know, the wisdom of some of the colleagues were, we'll just fund it through our budgeting process. And I was adamantly against that logic for this very reason. Now we're stuck with people who want to, you know, use their park, but they can't because of, you know, issues, and we don't have the funding, you know, and this is what taxpayers pay for, to have great parks, and we don't have the money to upgrade them when they need to be upgraded. A huge miss in our geo bond, but I want to make this a priority, John, in our budget cycle to finish this park.
And you said you're cooperating or coordinating with the local community, so is that like the homeowners associations, or how are you proceeding with deciding what to do and when to do it?
I'm not sure if you received the backup email. The gentleman's name is Jamie Straws. He's very involved. He represents the community. I don't believe it's a formal association as much as it is a group of residents who live near the park. He helped design. He pretty much helped design the playground, so we know that they're happy with that. He runs it through his neighbors. The phasing idea came from him, but we're not working with a specific association because I don't know if one exists right in that area.
Well, there is the Normandy, the
Normandy
Shores. Homeowners Association around there. They utilize this park. So I would suggest that you reach out and do a briefing with them, because what we don't want is for us to get going and doing this work and then have one of these associations come to us and say we weren't consulted, you know?
I apologize. Let me back up. We had our public meeting at Normandy Shores Golf Club. They were very involved and they blessed
us. Okay, perfect.
Yes.
So they know of your plans then?
Yes, they've seen it.
Okay. Okay.
They helped bring it to what it is today.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I may,
I'm supportive of the phasing because I think we want to get something going. I think almost a year ago, we talked about this item, and we had this discussion. So I guess what I want to learn, so for the future that we avoid this, what transpired over that period of time, and how do we make sure that we don't run into a similar situation? Because we had this phasing discussion. I'm thinking a little deja vu on this exact project. Can someone bring it to life? What happened?
I'm not quite sure how to answer that question. I remember the conversation.
Yeah.
There has been a budget gap for a long time.
And we talked about phasing, John.
We talked about this phasing.
I mean, I think this is, John, we had this conversation in almost a year ago about phasing this project because we had the budget gap and we wanted to get the ball going. And I really want to just understand so we all learn for the next round. I feel like we had this conversation that long ago.
This project's been around for about 3 years.
To your point, Chair, if you're planning to start in June, might we obviously want to get it going, but kids are out of school. This is when the park is probably going to have peak utilization. Would it be better to start in mid-August or September 1st? I mean, it's a delay of a few months, but are we going to have you thought about that?
Yes, we have thought about it, and we came up with the June date as a result of the community leader, the parent that we're dealing with. From an administrative standpoint, we need to get out to bid, we need to get good bids in, we need to get somebody in place. Whether we start June or we start August 1st or the first day of school, we're very flexible with that. But we were pushing for June as a result of the request from the community leader.
Can you start earlier? Can you start in April? No, you can't. Okay.
No, we don't have a bid process yet.
We will be starting our budget starting in May, looking at it and assuming, hopefully, that we have money to complete the bigger project. We would have approval for that late September. How might that impact your timeline on this? You can actually stage this, or are we better off? I hate delaying, especially with parks, but see how that budget discussion goes and doing it all in one fell swoop. Would that impact it financially, your timeline at all, or can you actually parcel this out?
The community specifically requested to please phase it, to please do not close their park as one construction site.
Okay.
So if we get the money, we could back up the phases where there's no gap.
Okay. Part of it is we don't want to close the whole park.
Correct.
The community wants. Okay.
Correct.
And I think that, if I may, Mr. Chair, I think the community is really anxious to see progress. So I like Vice Mayor Richards' question, if we could have started earlier, because I think this has been kicking around for a little while. So I think phasing soon is absolutely the case at this point.
Okay, so John, what do you need from us here?
I believe the commissioner you just wanted to hear on the record what the status is. Is that correct?
Yeah. So in terms of the plan, John, that I think we're supportive of the phasing. Would love if it was quicker. We're here in June.
Right.
What is the next step? Do you need a motion from this body? What do we need to do to proceed?
We're all good to proceed with the budget that we have
and
the scope that we're going to create. But you also brought up that we do have some gap funding that's now out in the open. So we'll work with John Woodruff during the capital budget process to see if we could get the remaining funding and maybe not have any gaps between these phases. Just go phase 1, 2, 3 and be finished.
And you might have said it, but just for the record, the construction on phase 1 begins in June, and that phase will be completed approximately when?
Minimum three months, but I need more details on the intricacies of the engineering for the drainage.
Got it.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for the update. This was helpful.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to excuse myself. I've got a meeting at 11.
No worries.
But what I'm going to do is I know there's some discussion items left, and I'll just pull up the tape and watch those.
Yeah. Thank you. Welcome to your first Finance Committee. It's nice serving with you, and I apologize that it ran so long. Normally, they do not run that long.
All right.
We'll try to fly through the next few. I have item number 4, but and I don't know if there's folks here. You're here. Do you have an update? Because I can defer this as well. Do you have something? I'll tee this up. This is a discussion regarding establishing a historic preservation fund. As I've said in the past, and I think we all agree, you know, historic preservation is, you know, core to who we are as a city here. You know, the city is 100 years old, and, you know, among the things we're known for is our architecture, and, you know, one of the things that we try to do is preserve our cultural cultural heritage, including buildings. But in the face of sea level rise and the threat to buildings and infrastructure, we need funding mechanisms to invest in our historic properties to make them resilient for the next 100 years. And one of the things I want to explore is creating some kind of fund and then some kind of appropriation mechanism so that some of our most cherished historic properties have the financing available that they wouldn't be able to attract traditionally through a fund that's established by the city. And I've asked staff to think about ideas, modeling things other communities have done, and to the extent that other communities haven't done this, then we would be, you know, sort of at the forefront of a creation of such a fund.
Mr. Chair, if I could just weigh in, because I'm supportive of this item. In fact, we have at Land Use and Sustainability an item related to private property adaptation. And, in fact, we've had some specific dialogues with the administration. San Francisco is a very innovative program where they're providing grants. And it has been my opinion that we need to better engage our community to be more resilient as well. My one request as it comes to this, and I've communicated this, but I'll say it again here, as we think about items like this, I want us to have a holistic view of all the pieces so we know where the money goes. Let me be specific. Certain amount of money needs to go for the streets, and that's important. Certain amount of money for historic properties, maybe some money for non-historic or not. Seawalls remain an item as well. And I just want to have the master plan so that before we put money here, if we know there's another area that needs money, that we've identified that. So I have requested from the city administration for our meeting in January that we have that master program, because I'd hate to allocate money towards one step and then wake up and say, well, we have no money for something else critical. But I am supportive of the direction of the item.
So what have you come up with?
Right now, we're just going to give you a brief update. Haiti Siegel is here from KCI. But to your point, Commissioner, we are looking at those funding mechanisms that you had identified before, and Haiti's team has come up with those. And also, it's not necessarily just an appropriation to do this or that, but maybe to address greater issues that are facing the city with historic properties. But I'm going to let her give you her update. We will be coming back next month with a final, once you tell us that we're definitely on the right track, so that we can move forward with next steps.
Good morning. Heidi Siegel with KCI. So we were, as a reminder, we were in front of you in September and October, and you sent us away to come back and identify the types of projects, how they might be ranked, and the implementation of the program. The Historic Preservation Fund was originally recommended through the North Beach Master Plan in 2016. Part of our study, we looked at applying this citywide. Our initial recommendation at this time is to limit it to North Beach, to the Normandy Isles and North Shore Historic Districts, to allow it to get up and running and do some good work as the fund continues to grow, and then once all the kinks are worked out, perhaps apply it citywide. As far as types of projects, our recommendations include facade repairs as well as life safety repairs, such as in North Beach, the historic railings on the buildings might not meet fire code today, and also some of those resiliency projects, which include roof improvement, structural repairs, as well as elevating seawalls, and if the fund grows, elevating buildings. We're recommending a ranking of the projects, with Category 1 being the highest priority, which are structures that contribute to the historic significance, either architecturally or historically, of Miami Beach. Category 2 would be projects contributing towards climate adaptation. And Category 3 would be the applicant has a financial hardship. So that would be part of the ranking matrix, as well as whether it's a specific area catalyst project, properties that are visible from a major corridor, or properties that may provide workforce or affordable housing. Some of our recommendations for the implementation include creating a board or a committee that would oversee the distribution of the funds by ranking the project so it's out of staff's hands, most likely not to be housed in the planning department because you don't want to have conflicts as building permits come through. We're also looking at what the grant split would be, whether it be a 50-50, that each party is responsible, that the city would be at an 80% and the applicant at 20%, or the city at a 60% and 40%. So those are the highlights, and based on us having previous presentations in front of you of where we are right now.
Two quick comments. One, I absolutely like the idea of some matching sort of program. I don't have a percent, but of the two you said, I sort of like the 50-50 more than I like the city funding 80-20. Mm-hmm. And second, I'm sort of intrigued and open by the idea of starting in North Beach, but I'd like to think about it candidly. I just want to, was there any particular reason that we picked that?
It did come from the North Beach Master Plan, so there's a focus there for new preservation efforts up there. And second, you are going to have limited funds as this starts to grow. So to keep it concentrated and the idea that you start to see the work come together and that it improves an entire area more quickly than being spread out the entire city.
Yep. My final quick comment is things that help us adapt to flooding, for me, is a high priority. As I think about the score, we have flooding today. How is this money going to directly help property owners address that? That would be a top priority.
Here's what I'm thinking, right? One is the city has to do its part to build the infrastructure to protect us, to make sure we're here for another 100 years. Otherwise, this is pointless because we can invest all the money in the world in properties we want to preserve, but if the seas are going to rise and we're going to be underwater, it's all for naught. So one is working off the premise that we will do our part to build the infrastructure to appropriately address the dangers of climate change. And secondly, really, this is a long-term vision for me. This will probably be implemented after we're out of office. But it's with a 100-year view to try to identify the very best properties we have in our city that are unique and really embody our culture and they're best in class, so that we have the financial mechanism to preserve those long term. So an example would be if you look at the pyramids of Egypt, if over the centuries someone hadn't been taking care of them, they would have succumbed to the natural elements. Or, you see what's happening in Venice now. They're not going to be able to save that entire city. But, St. Mark's Church, certain things you must be able to save. I want to be able to have some kind of financial pot of money to save the very best of our historic buildings. But we have to do our part to build the infrastructure so that this isn't futile exercise. But this isn't something that's going to happen in the next year. This is something really to start planning for the coming decade so that we have money to preserve the very best historical assets that we have in our city while we're trying to build the infrastructure we need to make sure that we're here in 100 years. That's where I'm going with this. Because we're not going to be able to save every single piece of property in the city. That's not what this is. How about this is your item, Commissioner Samuel, sure. Item number six, talking about the BRT.
Yep. I think this is a quarterly update, so in the interest of time, maybe we just sort of get the top lines, any decision required by us at this point.
No, I think I can do a one-sentence update on each of the three topics.
Okay.
The Transit Pass program is working very well with a boost in ridership up into the 70s. Of city employees, with 11 of those being residents of Miami Beach. The BERT project is continuing to finish the preliminary reports. Design will be starting in June, with construction coming in June of 2022. There is going to be an important meeting on January 22nd because the operating funds that we were awarded, the $5.1 million, are not in the FDOT work program. So we're meeting with the TPO, FDOT, and us to find out what's going on there. So we're going to work through that. So the 150, there are two conflicting county recommendations on it. The Cambridge Systematics studied our proposed alignment and concurred with it. The Better Bus Project came out with a scenario that proposes eliminating it and replacing it with a Route 120, which runs along Flagler Street to the airport. The idea is that they would get more ridership from the local neighborhood. So really the shift of the route would change to more a workforce orientation and less a tourism focus. So we're working with them through that. They should be bringing the Better Bus Project through the city, through the county approvals in the spring and the summer.
Linda, I appreciate the one-line updates. It's very helpful.
Close to one line.
So, yeah, no problem. So okay. Just a question. If I heard you right, design, uh-huh. The BERT is the only one I want to ask about at this point. Okay. The BERT on the dedicated line on the Julia Tuttle, I think I heard design mm-hmm. June.
June.
Okay. And as that kicks off, we're going to loop in all the stakeholders, including the 41st Street Committee, mm-hmm. and we're going to give thought to after the bus comes over its dedicated lane, mm-hmm. where it goes, how it goes, does it connect to the trolley? That's all part of that design, and those stakeholders will be part of it, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Perfect. Okay.
Thank you.
Let's see. John, what's left?
9, 10, 11.
9, 10, 11. Let's see. So we have e-cigarettes. We've got the Realty Trust. Let's do a quick update on number 9.
Good morning. At the request of the City's Youth Commission, we had engaged Miami-Dade County Public Schools to provide information on the dangers of e-cigarettes. We obtained information from the Food and Drug Administration and have distributed that information to our high school, our middle school, and our K-8 center, in addition to posting that information at our Parks and Recreation departments. We have engaged a drug prevention and intervention specialist who provided sessions to our parents and to youth these past 2 years, and we will be working with that organization to also provide additional sessions to youth and to provide a series to our parents. We've contemplated also doing a panel discussion through a community event, and communications has provided some outreach as well.
And the other options that we had talked about, if you wanted to do some external advertising for this to get the message more, you know, out in the community in a more mass market way, the options are wrapping trolleys and or placing bus shelters, both of which do come with an expense, which is kind of what we would be discussing here today. To wrap a trolley is $2,500 per trolley, and that is solely our expense to print and install it. And for the bus shelters, to print and install on those is $150 per shelter. So there's the options to consider those two methods to get the word out as well. We did look at, like she said, the FDA, and they already have an extensive campaign. That is what we've used for ads. That's what we've used to place in the magazine, as well as create the flyers and banners for the schools, and the videos that we have running on MBTV, and the trolleys monitors are also from the FDA.
The $2,500 for the bus, is that a one-time expense?
So, yes. Well, yes, that is as long as it is up. So to wrap one trolley
right.
is $2,500, and that is – they don't charge us to rent the trolleys. That's the joy of partnering with them in our city. So it is just solely the cost to print and install. If – so they were to sell the trolley – it would have to come down because we get remnant space, and then if we wanted to put it back up, we would have to pay $2,500 again.
Then it's $150 per bus stop. Mm-hmm. Is that again a one-time expense? As
yes.
Okay. Do you all have a recommendation? Sounds like we have some good things we're doing at no cost, mm-hmm. which is good. Or
Well, the drug prevention sessions that we provide, we already have funds for that, and so that's already in the budget.
No incremental cost, I should say. And then, so I guess the issue on the table is there any amount of funding that the administration recommends so that we could do something on a trolley or a bus? That's really the decision in front of us. Do you all have a strong recommendation here that we need additional funding, or we think what we have is covered?
We have done a significant amount of free advertising, free being utilizing the tools that we have at our disposal. So like she said, we've included an e-blast, the MB magazine, we've done the MBTV, the trolley videos, the monitors inside. I guess if there was a desire to do a more mass market, then we would look at the trolleys and the bus shelters.
So trolleys and buses are fine, but I mean, we're talking about teenagers, right? They're on Snap, they're on Instagram, stuff like that. What about social media and doing advertising?
We are doing some social media posts. We could absolutely put some funding towards some paid advertisements and do some geofencing and some targeted marketing on social media as well.
Yeah, let us know what that budget would look like to just, you know, target Miami Beach kids, so it won't be that expensive on, you know, Facebook and Instagram and Snap.
Snapchat. I think our youth commission would be very supportive of that. We've spoken with them about.
You've got a bunch of older folks.
Yeah, their Facebook is not really their thing.
talking as if we're marketing to ourselves. We're marketing to kids. And yeah, some of them take the bus and trolleys, but they're much more on their phones. And so if you want to get in front of them, you got to go where they're at. So
I think that's smart. I like and support that. Tanya, Leslie, do you have off the cuff sort of a small scale get the ball going number, or is that something you want to think about and come back to us?
Well, I can tell you that for social media advertising, you can start with as little as, you know, just a couple $100s and go up to, you know, a larger, like $1,000 per month. And it depends exactly on your target market and who your demographic is and how you're hitting them, because the price for social media advertising is generally per person, per view. So you pay depending on how many people see it. So how deep you get into targeting is going to limit the amount of people that see it, so the money goes a little bit further.
Yeah.
So the idea is maybe we could start with around like $500 and see how that goes, and based on that, I could maybe come back to Mr. Woodruff and ask for another $500 when it's successful.
I don't even think you got it. If that's what you're asking for, don't even bring it to this committee anymore. I mean, that's well within the city manager's threshold. We'll just give you direction
to,
you know, spend money to make sure you get in front of kids. And I would probably spend money on social media rather than a bus shelter or a trolley.
Yeah.
You know, so just do it and then report back in 90 days and how the efforts are going.
Absolutely. Will do.
So done. Okay. Great.
Thank you.
Let's do 10 and 11.
Yep.
Who's going to represent number 10?
Good morning. Adrian Morales, Property Management Director. What you have before you is an item to discuss the improvements on the 1100 block of Lincoln Road. So the city was approached by Bornado Realty Trust, who own the building on the south side of the 1100 block of Lincoln Road, and they're interested in paying for design and construction services related to some of those improvements that you see before in the memo included in the package. Essentially, what we're asking this committee is to allow us to move forward to put together an agreement with Vornado to pay for those design and construction on the 1100 block, which include landscape redesign from the Raymond Jungles plan in 2010, a custom bollard, and that's consistent with the rest of the Lincoln Road project that you've seen for the last few years.
And I think the request is $100,000 roughly?
For design, at some point we'll come back with the actual construction cost, and this won't be the first time you see it. So this item will go from finance, it'll go to commission for an agreement, and then it'll go for an amendment to the James Corner contract to add this scope.
And approximately how much is Vornado, round numbers, what are they looking to invest in this area?
They're willing to pay for whatever the improvements cost.
Order of magnitude, what could that be? Just ballpark.
A few $100,000. You're looking at landscaping, you're looking at custom bollard fronting Alton Road. We don't have a rough cost
over
magnitude.
Just the bollards will be that much.
It's probably in that $200,000 to $400,000 range. Just because based on the numbers that we've seen on the bollards, it's difficult to say just yet. I mean, I would have to get the consultant to put some something to paper. What they're trying to accomplish is enhance visibility to the retail space.
Right.
What they feel is that the Jungles plan from 2010 doesn't accomplish that, and they're also trying to kind of make their section of the road more cohesive with the rest of it, which isn't. And you hear at times it's a lot different. So because this consultant's already worked on this project for so long, that this would kind of tie everything in.
So we would be paying, you know, more or less $100,000 for all the design work. Vornado is going to...
No. Vornado would be paying for design and construction of... So they would be picking up this cost. They approached us saying, hey, we would like to pay for this.
Oh, they'll pay for this?
They'll pay for this.
So what are we doing? We're just pre-funding it?
No, we're not asking for it. We're just so typically what happens is before we engage into an agreement of this type, similar to the Sunset Islands or something like that, we come to Finance Committee just to kind of review this project to then move forward with an agreement. And I'll defer to Ralph.
Yeah, very simply, we would negotiate and execute a funding agreement with Vornado for them to cover all of the design and construction costs, and then we would enter into the change orders with our contractors subject to receiving funding from Vornado.
Correct.
Okay.
So our role today is to thank Vornado for paying for their $100,000 to make this better for all of us.
Essentially, yes.
Okay. I think that's a good idea.
And the reason this is brought on is this is a typical process
yep,
for a new
no problem.
Project that we
okay.
come to committee
I think
to
we're
discuss.
Good. Got it. Okay.
Yep.
Thanks.
Perfect. Thank you.
And then number 11, is that Matt? Matt, this is the Orange Bowl for next year. We have the championship game next year?
We do.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So the question I had is, what did we do last time in terms of how much money we
It was so I'll have to go back to see those exact. City manager had recommended that we do a similar to the Super Bowl because the economic impact, return, hotel contracts,
yeah.
and whatnot are the same. So I can come back with that exact number, but we're actually recommending a little bit less than obviously what they requested. They came in with everything, and we've gone back with almost an identical request of the Super Bowl. So this would be for 2021, and the game would take place. It is worth noting that... unlike the Super Bowl, they're holding a lot of events on the beach here. So they're going to have a three-day concert. ESPN has their largest setup they've done for the Orange Bowl that's going to be happening in Lummis Park. They're looking at potentially taking over the Fillmore, which we are not recommending doing a fee waiver for. It's a third party. We're, you know, rent it. The one thing we're not recommending is they've asked for waivers of all corkage fees at the convention center and the Fillmore. We're not recommending that because that's obviously how we make our money is on our food and beverage. We are recommending rental waivers for the convention center. So all in all, very similar to a Super Bowl, we are getting a three-day concert in addition to what we've seen kind of for similar funding.
If I may, I got two quickies. Yeah. Matt, do you think we've pushed the envelope as much as we can on community benefits, anything good for the residents, anything that we could sort of push around on that angle?
Yeah, I think we can push back a little bit more on that.
Okay.
The resident benefits itself have not been nailed down quite yet, but I know they're very – so far they've been great to work with.
Good. Let's do that. I'm supportive of the direction. I think that would be one. And second, the Super Bowl is just around the corner, so it sounds like you're coming back, which is great because in case there are any learnings
right.
coming out of the Super Bowl experience, that gets baked in.
Yeah, the earliest this would come back would be commission in February, so Super Bowl.
Yeah, so there's no real urgency to this item here?
They have said they plan about a year out and obviously want their funding.
Maybe you say directionally we're supportive. We don't know the dollar amount
yep.
exactly, but,
yeah.
you know, ballparks
and
were there.
I told them I would not be able to make a firm recommendation to the full commission until I see exact resident benefits.
Because I'm with Commissioner Samuel, and I'd like to learn from our Super Bowl experience. It'll
yep.
be fresh in our minds so that we can craft, you know, a definitive yep. plan for what we want to do for the championship next
what
year.
What we could do, too, is tell them that it's been approved through finance, and maybe we wait till March commission to give it an extra month or two to work.
Yeah. I mean, we'll refine the numbers and the public benefit asks, but I think...
Or would you want it to come back to committee with a more detailed proposal after Super Bowl?
Let's bring it to finance because I think the
February finance.
General commission would appreciate us vetting the numbers.
Yeah. So we'll come back to
yeah.
finance.
Yeah, and just come back
February.
To us with what did we spend for the last
yeah.
championship, not the last Orange Bowl. Any recommendations you have, having looked at what we learned from the Super Bowl?
Yeah.
Commissioner Samuelin's... comment about, you know, what public benefits might
right.
we incorporate here. And then I think we can come up with a firm recommendation.
I agree.
Great.
Wonderful. Thanks, Matt.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, I think that's all our items. I'm sorry this went so long, but we covered a lot of ground. Okay, I'll see you all Wednesday.